Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and this is my Tech Guy podcast. This is a very special Tech Guy podcast that we're putting out New Year's Eve 2017, the best tidbits from the year gone by. But I'll be back with a brand new show for you this Saturday, January 6th. Make sure you tune in for that. This is episode 1450. Happy holidays. Happy New Year. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by GoToWebinar, a trusted webinar platform with over 55,000 customers who've hosted over 2.7 million interactive web events to connect with their audiences. For more, visit GoToWebinar.com/podcast. Hello, everybody. You're watching a special, or you're going to watch or listen to a special Tech Guy podcast. I'm not here. I'm on vacation, and as is all the Twit staff, and that's awesome. But we did want to bring you a new show, so what we thought we'd do, as we've done with other shows on our network, is put together a best of some of the best moments, the best questions, the weirdest answers from Tech Guy shows all throughout 2017, and that's what you're about to listen to. I thank you so much for tuning in the Tech Guy, and I hope you enjoy this holiday best of the Tech Guy for New Year's Eve. Stay safe out there tonight, okay? Back to Pennsylvania we go. Vernon is on the line. Hi, Vernon.
Hi, how are you doing, Leo?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm a longtime listener, and I listen to you and Steve Gibson all the time.
Right on. That's and our security podcast, Security Now. Yeah.
Right. And now I have a security question.
Okay.
That either I wasn't paying attention or I missed that episode. Last week, my insurance company said they were going to send me some secure documents in an email. And I contacted them over the telephone, and they said they would email this to me. And I waited for the email. I didn't get an email.
Uh-oh.
So then I waited, so I called them back and said, I didn't get the email. Well, they'll send it again. So they sent the email again. I didn't get that email. So on the third try, I said, by the way, is there anything in these documents that would be pertinent to my account?
Everything.
Yeah, right.
Your social security number, your home address, your birth date, everything.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So on the third call, I started to question them about the security of this attachment they sent in the email. And they said, oh, don't worry about it. It's encrypted. So I said, that's fine. I finally, on the third email try, I got the email. And there was this attachment. And when I tried to open it, I got this window that came up. And it had me enter my information, my name, my first name, last name, and a password, and then verified the password and a secure question. And I'm thinking, how is this working? You know, it's like I'm giving them the password, you know.
Well, so there wasn't a prearranged password? You didn't have you didn't have a login or something?
No.
It asked you for a password, and it could be anything you wanted.
Right. As a matter of fact, I started to question this after I did this, and of course, then I could open the attachment, obviously.
That's for future reference. You would be required in future to give it the password, I would guess.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I thought too.
You're creating an account, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. So I had in the process asked them to send, since I wasn't getting the email at one address, I asked them to send it at a different one as well. So I figured now after I had done this on the first receiving of the email, I'd try it on the other email account and see if I entered different information, if it would still allow me to open the same email.
Interesting.
It allowed me to open the same email.
So in other words, it didn't really matter what you entered.
Right. Exactly.
Well, that's not encryption, is it?
Yes. I think what it might be is they don't understand how to use this encryption tool. I think they should be entering my account information, my name, and assigning a password, and then telling me this
yes.
over the telephone.
Yeah, or mailing it, physical mail. That's what a lot of financial companies do, is They'll say, we're going to create a pin for you. We're going to mail this to you, thereby having a secondary channel, making it harder for an attacker, plus verifying your physical address.
Right.
And that's a fairly secure way to do it. So maybe they didn't understand how it works. Were they using a technology like DocuSign? Does that ring a bell, DocuSign?
No, there was nothing on it other than the insurance company's logo.
So there is a widely used service, secure service called DocuSign, and often it makes you make an account if you don't have a doc. If you have a DocuSign account, you can log into it. If you don't, it says, "Oh, well, let's make an account for you."
Mm-hmm.
But you're clearly you've been listening carefully to security now because you're making an excellent point. Anybody who received that email or intercepted that email could enter anything they want.
Exactly.
And it would encrypt and open up the document.
So I just wondered, there wasn't something I missed in one of your...
not that I know of. I'm trying to think, and I'll ask, we'll have to query Steve Gibson, the host of the show, because he's the real guru there. But I'm a apprentice guru by virtue of listening to 600 of his shows. And he's probably listening right now. He does listen to the radio show. So Steve, if you're listening, call in. But I'm trying to think of... did it have to be your email that you entered in that account?
No,
email. Oh, you entered a different one. Yeah,
it had a position for your first name, last name, password, verification of the password, and secure secret message. You know, favorite pet. What I think.
Yeah, yeah. So you were creating an account of some kind.
Yeah, exactly.
And you had to do that before the document opened up.
That's correct.
Okay. So the next time you open the document, I hope they send you a document. I hope it will not give you that dialogue, but instead say, what's the password you created? However, that first time, that document they sent is not secured.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I got a second document, but unfortunately this was to a different email address, but it was the same document to a different email address.
Yeah.
And went through the same process when I clicked.
Yeah, but now having created an account.
No, I used a different password.
And it unlocked again.
Yes, exactly. So I guess, you know, I had called them back on this. There was a number to ask if you had any questions about this secure email. And I questioned this whole thing, and they had no explanation for this at all.
They don't know how it works. That's why.
Yes, they. It was obvious from the person I talked to. They did not know how it works.
Is this a big insurance company? And then you were talking to an agent.
This is a major insurance company.
And were you talking to an employee of that company or an employee of an agency that was selling you the insurance?
No. I was talking to the representative of the company.
So it was a big financial institution you were talking to.
Yes, yes, a big financial.
I'm guessing they're using. There are a couple of services like DocuSign, and the chat room is confirming that that is kind of the DocuSign sign up. You could read the documents clearly?
Oh, once I had entered this password,
everything was there
perfectly.
And at that point, it had
pertinent information in it.
Yeah, and at that point, was the purpose of you receiving that to sign it?
No, eventually, but I wouldn't be returning it signed. It was just to basically get the form, but all the information that had to do with my account was already pre-filled in.
Yeah, so that's not a very... The method is clearly insecure.
I don't think there's any doubt about it.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt either.
Well, I was dreaming about this, and I was thinking, well, maybe I missed something in this whole... You know, when I listen to you and Steve goes into so much detail sometimes that
you maybe missed it.
Over.
Well, the reason I was thinking DocuSign, first of all, a lot of companies use it. And its intent is we'll send you a document, then you click here and you've signed it. And they make you create the account basically as to associate that signature with you for future purposes. But that doesn't sound like what this was. This sounds like something else.
No, they did not do that at all.
So this is, you know, the problem in the world in general is that, you know, this stuff has far outpaced the knowledge of the people using it. And unfortunately, hackers are now everywhere. And so everyone knows it's easy to intercept email. It has to go through a bunch of servers just to get to you. And at any point along the line, it sounds like whoever was on those servers could have viewed your document.
Well, I asked the person when I called back, how do you know that, you know, the person that received that email was me?
Yeah. Was the document a physical attachment, or was it a link back to the...
No, it's a physical attachment.
Yeah, no, it doesn't sound like that's secure, and it's interesting that it's a big company. Hang on. After we go off the air, I'd like to know the name of the company. Maybe we could pursue
this.
All right. Hang on. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
You're out.
So, what was the name of the company?
It's AXA Equitable.
Equitable. Oh, that's a pretty large insurance company.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty big...
Wow.
Well, at least they have a big building in New York City.
Yeah, well, that's how they get that big building, is by charging you money for insurance. If it was DocuSign, you will see in the URL, and it might be kind of hidden, obscured, the email. Did the email have a clickable link, or did you just go to the attachments and open the attachment?
It does have a clickable link.
Okay, so that's how you open the document?
That's how I open the document.
Okay.
Right?
This sounds more and more like DocuSign, but so you look at the URL you are looking at when you click the link. Does it say DocuSign anywhere in that URL?
Nope.
What's the base URL for that?
Let me go back here and see the base. It's got a long
alphabet. Yeah. There's a lot of crap, but the thing before the .com.
It's secureemail.axa.us.com.
AXA. AXA, securemail.axa.us.com.
Right.
All right. Well, let me look into what AXA is, because that's the provider. It does sound like that document is not physically attached to the email, but at that link.
Yeah, I would kind of agree with it. It looks like when I look at the email, there is kind of an attachment thing there, but that isn't the way I open them.
That's probably a key of some kind. So... AXA, helping families and businesses take... AXA is an insurance company, a financial company.
Yes. Yeah, in this case, it's a retirement.
Retirement.
Thing.
So that's they're storing that on their own. So let's see what secure email is. I don't know what secure... So it was securemail.axa.us.com?
No, wait. I got to go back and look at it. I just closed it.
So AXA is the insurance company.
Yeah, AXA is the insurance company.
So they sometimes, you know, they you know.
Okay, it's an HTTPS address, securemail.axa.us.com.
Yeah.
And after that, it's / form post dir.
So they have a page on sending secure email. So they have a send secure email process. When an AXA service representative needs to send you confidential information, you may agree to receive it via email. We will use send secure email. The email will be encrypted before it's sent. Yes, okay. When you receive a secure encrypted email, the confidential information contained in the email will arrive as an attachment named axasecuredoc.html, which is in fact.
Right.
You'll need to open this attachment in order to read the confidential information. Download it. Open it. This is the most reliable means of opening the attachment. Okay.
That didn't sound complete, did it?
Simply double-clicking on the attachment may produce... Okay, got it. For most users, an envelope image will appear. So there is some code being run here. The question is how they're verifying... So...
I want to know how they're verifying
Verifying your who you are.
Yeah.
In some cases, if the sender's secure email determined it required additional security, the envelope image will remain on your screen. It will prompt you to supply a password... or to register your email address with AXA before you can view the contents of the email. That's for their audit purposes, not for security, I might add. Clients who register fully registered use. See, I don't know how they're validating that, you know, authenticating you.
That's the problem. I don't understand. And that's what they could not explain to me.
Well, they don't know because that's a customer service rep. They have no idea. I'm gonna have to keep looking into this. We gotta go, but let me keep looking into this. At least we've given him enough information for him to look and find out more.
All right, thank you very much.
Take care, sir.
I appreciate it.
Good question.
And, say hello to Steve.
I will. Thanks.
Bye.
Scott Wilkinson is the editor in chief of the AVS Forum at avsforum.com. All about audio and visual systems, hence the AVS.
He's audio, video, science.
Science. It's science. He blinded me with science. You have on the front page, thank you for putting it there this week. It happened a couple of weeks ago, right? The results from the shootout. Now, what is? Tell me about the shootout.
Oh, the flat panel TV shootout. This is, by some counts, the 13th or 14th year that it's that it has occurred. It went through some changes this year. It's now associated with an event in New York called CE Week, which is more or less kind of a micro version of CES. Companies get together, show their stuff for the summer and what have you. And one of the events is this flat panel TV shootout where the flagship TVs from as many companies as we can get, they can get, are assembled, put right next to each other, calibrated, all fed the same signal, and people come in and evaluate them and vote. Now, in the past, the vote was by audience. So anybody who showed up got a ballot and scored these TVs on a variety of categories: black level, color accuracy, contrast, brightness, that sort of thing.
Now, didn't this used to be held by a Long Island television sales company?
Well, by a retailer.
Retailer.
Yes, a store in upstate New York.
Or upstate New York, okay.
Yeah, called Value Electronics.
Value Electronics. So they're no longer associated with this? Or?
Well, they're sort of associated with it, but it was determined or decided that there was a little bit too much salesness involved because it was from a retailer and he used TVs from his own stock.
Now it's Joel Silver, who's the founder of
Joel Image Silver. He's a totally independent
Foundation.
Guy. Yeah. Yeah, Imaging Science Foundation, very smart guy. And the judging is no longer done by the audience, but by a panel of experts. And I mean Hollywood colorists.
So people really spend a lot of time looking and thinking about this. Is the goal to get the most realistic reproduction, or is the goal to make it look the most like the Hollywood movie intended? Do you know the difference? You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. Absolutely. And for that reason, the goal is to reproduce the director's intent as closely as
possible. When it's a movie, that's for sure. And when you're watching a baseball game, is it still, it's really what the director and the network wanted you to see, not what the grass actually looks like.
Well, yeah, exactly. What is it that the TV station is sending you?
Because they have, and I know this from working in television, there's people in the back called shaders, and in movies they're called colorists or color timers from the real old days when it had to do with how long you left the film in a developing bath.
Yes, exactly.
But the color timers, the colorists, and the shaders, these people are really the magic eyes that determine what you see. And I guess what you want is a TV to reflect what they're trying to
get to. Exactly. Right? And for that reason, at the shootout, not only were there, I believe, six TVs from manufacturers, consumer TVs, but there was also a Sony broadcast video monitor, a $30,000, 30-inch OLED TV that is used in...
That's what the shaders are looking at, really.
What they're looking at.
Right.
Exactly.
Because they don't want a television to have a color cast and then you adjust for that, but nobody else sees that.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So, and these were they pre-calibrated these flat panels. And how do they choose the flat panels? Which ones are?
They're the flagships. They're the top
from
of the
LG,
line from each
Sony,
manufacturer.
Samsung.
Yep.
Vizio.
Yep.
They had an entry from Westinghouse.
Yeah, that was kind of a last minute thing, and the Westinghouse did not perform as well because it doesn't have all the calibration controls. For one thing, they couldn't calibrate it. To the same
specification. So this isn't as it came out of the box. This is after it's professionally calibrated by SpectraCal to get it.
Precisely.
So the SpectraCal guy is now getting it as close as possible to true color.
Yep.
And then you're judging
to what
TV.
Are called the system. Yeah. With content that is spread, that is played and using an HDMI splitter.
So what are you
sent
measuring
to all the TVs?
Then? You're measuring.
Well, you're measuring the color of white, the color of the primaries.
How close it can get.
to the what are called the system standards.
Interesting.
So there are very specific standards for where the white point should be, where what the color of white should be. If you look at a white thing, you can see it maybe looks a little yellowish or a little bluish or whatever. You need that. There's a very specific color of white, so we say.
So this is kind of different than the way it used to be, because when Value Electronics did it. Didn't they just take it out of the box and say?
No.
Oh, they calibrated it also.
Too.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
See, I wanted to take it out of the box and put it in cinema mode, and then say, because most people buy a TV, that's the calibration they do.
That's true, but when you're doing something like this, where you really want to compare one TV against another side by side, you really need them to be on a level playing field.
All right, that's fair,
and I think that that's important.
So we've been burying the lead here because now everybody wants to know. Well, but I think you have to understand what winning means in this context.
Exactly.
So this is the panel that is best able to reproduce the intent of the director.
And in fact, there were instead of one category of just which is the best, this year they did three categories: which was the best in a dark room setting, like a grading studio or a home theater; which was best in a bright room setting; and which was best at streaming content, which is, as you know, not as good as coming off of a disc. And so, which TV best renders a streamed, a somewhat compromised image?
Was the presumption that the Sony mastering, the $30,000 Sony reference monitor, accurate? And are they measuring who comes closest to that?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Well, who won? Exactly. Tell us.
It was LG. The LG E7 OLED won all three categories.
Really? Because that's the one. Yep. Well, I bought its predecessor, but
you bought the B6, which was last year's.
Same panel.
This year's same panel. Yeah. Well, roughly, they might have improved it a little.
Oh, I'm sure they have this year, but I'm just glad that brand won.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I will tell you this: the Sony OLED, the A1E, scored so close to the LG that they decided they had to give it an honorable mention, because it really could have gone either way.
So OLEDs won, though, in both cases.
In all cases, OLEDs won, yes. Even against the Sony Z9, which is their flagship LCD TV, and that thing is a cannon. I mean, a light cannon. It puts out so much more light than the OLEDs. But the OLED contrast, I think, really was what won everybody
out. But see, that's an important point. It doesn't mean everybody should run out and buy an OLED. Cost aside, they are more expensive.
You
may want a brighter TV because it's in a living room and you can't close the windows or whatever.
Exactly. In which case, you do want to consider an LCD. Right. Although I will say that I have an OLED now in my theater, and even when I have the lights on, it's plenty bright enough.
I'm
perfectly
OLED.
Happy with it.
Me too, man. Last year's winner. More
anyway, LG OLED.
All the deets on the website, avsforum.com. Scott, thank you so much. More of your calls coming up. 8888 Ask Leo. Let's talk tech right after this. Deborah, Rancho Palos Verdes, Leo Laporte. Hi, Deborah.
Hello, Leo. Thank you so much for taking my call. This is kind of like a public service.
It's a public service, but I get paid for it. I'm not going to lie to you. I make a living at it.
Okay, well, I'll greatly appreciate it.
Like most public servants, I'm cashing in.
All right. Well, you deserve it.
Thank you.
Yes, definitely.
Actually, I'm not cashing in like most public servants. Not anywhere near that. But go ahead.
Okay.
What can I do for you?
I hope I'm wording this correctly, because even though I listen to you, I don't always understand what you're talking about. So I'm not as techie as a lot of your other callers are. But I am trying to figure out when somebody... Okay, I know when you log into a website, that website, that server, and your own computer will show where you logged into and what time you did it.
Yeah.
Unless somebody erases it somehow.
That's right. That's in your browser history.
Okay. What if somebody, i.e. a student, my daughter, logs in during a class onto a website, which they're supposed to be logging into? It's called Learning Catalytics.
Good.
And, which I never heard of, but... And she doesn't have to keep logging into it, but what happens is the professor wants the kids to attend the class, even though he provides everything so that you could do it from some remote location.
So it's an online learning site that professor is recommending, and he does keep track. Is this what you're saying? And he keeps track of whether the students use it or not.
Well, what he wants to keep track of is that the kids actually show up in class even though they wouldn't have to. So he expects the kids to go to class. He doesn't use sign-in sheets except for 2 days during this entire semester.
Yeah.
First day, she does the sign-in sheet. Second day, she misses the sign-in sheet. He circulates the thing while they're taking the quiz. So it starts off with a quiz. Then the time period for the, you know, the availability, the ability of a kid to be able to take the quiz, that shuts down. He's got this projector. He shines it on the wall. He does his lecture. He talks for, you know, 5-10 minutes about some topic. And then there will be some little symbol on the wall, on the projector, that says, that prompts the kids to then
log in. Okay.
Ask a question.
Yeah.
Now, by then, all the kids in the class, there's like 35 to 40 kids in the class, by then all their screens have gone blank, and they all have to refresh their screens in order to do this.
Right.
If you're in the class, which my kid was, I need an IT perspective to try to help her prove that she was in fact in class. Because this was 2 months ago. She doesn't remember what the guy was wearing. She doesn't remember if it was...
So he's asking her for proof because she's not on the sign-up sheet that she was there, so that she can get credit. And you're hoping that her computer will demonstrate that she was there.
That would be a godsend. So when she presses this refresh button, is that... I mean, you know, it's not like logging in. When you do your refresh button...
No, but the computer, the browser would have a record of her being... It wouldn't prove that she was in the class, but it would have a record of her being on that site at that time.
Would it prove, like, kind of timestamp exactly when she was...
Yeah, but remember, she could do that from home, too.
But here's the thing, she can't. Because all the people, you know, sitting in their pajamas in their apartments... All they see is a blank screen. They don't see the professor.
Ah.
Their screens, after they, you know, illegally take their quiz at their remote location.
What school is this? Is this reform school?
It is a wonderful top university.
Nice.
East of the Mississippi.
Okay.
California, but no, and it's a great place.
And you're a tiger mom, because you're not going to let this slide.
Well, no, here's the reason. She will not be able to apply to med school for 2 years because of this honor code violation.
That's ridiculous. Okay.
Tell me right. I know.
So,
I know
yeah. It. So her laptop's browser, the browser she used, will have a record of all the websites she visited with a time and date stamp. So you can say, you could take a screenshot of it and send it to them and say, look, here it is, proof positive. On this date, at this time, she was on that website.
But will it show when she refreshed her screen? See, here's the deal.
Yes.
Oh, it does.
Well, okay, so you're saying she logged into that website before she entered the classroom?
No, she enters the classroom. She logs on the website.
Yeah, it'll show that moment. Now, so he needs, it's more than just being there. He needs to verify that she refreshed her screen at that particular time?
Well, see, that's the only way I can distinguish her actions from the kids sipping their coffee in their kitchens. What they can do is they'll see a blank screen, but they'll have to keep refreshing their computers like every 2 minutes because they have no idea when the professor...
Depends what you mean by a refresh. If you mean she hit F5 and refreshed the browser, it will record that.
I think that's what she means.
Yeah. She needs to, though, do this quickly because history doesn't last forever. It depends on how the setting, but typically just a few months. How long ago was this?
February 4.
Yeah, she'd be all right.
Okay.
But she has to do it now. So tell her to look in her browser history and scroll back to that date and time, and there should be an entry there for that website. I can't promise you that this famous school east of the Mississippi will accept this. But boy, that seems like a shame to prevent her from applying to med school for 2 years because of this. Seems dopey.
It's actually kind of tragic. We're trying to take it from
no kidding.
Because if
she's devastated, I'm sure, and she was there.
Yeah, she was. She was.
I'm sure she's devastated, and really, that seems like a flimsy thread to hang somebody's med school admission on the fact that they saw the sign up sheet go by during the quiz. Seems like a very flimsy thread.
That's right. Plus, he only did it twice during the entire semester, so it's not something you
would
see.
What a dope.
I know.
What a dope. Okay. I think you should, well, frankly, I think you could appeal this to a higher authority and And
you know, I can't even go there right now. I'm just trying to be real practical.
Yeah. I understand. Yeah, tell her, honey. Leo says you can look at your browser history, and there should be an entry there at that date and time saying you were on that website. Whether the professor, who sounds like a real martinet, whether he'll accept it or not is another matter. He's not bound to.
So even when she refreshes it, it'll show when she refreshed it, because she would have only had to refresh her browser like 5 times.
Yes, it should show every time that she refreshed her browser.
Oh, thank
not waking
you.
Up the machine, you know, because the screen goes blank, but actually refreshing the browser page. Yeah, every one of those is logged.
Yeah, well, she would have to. It would have to involve.
Well, I don't. Yeah, I'm not sure I understand how this works. But yes, tell her to look in the history and hope she can find it there. She also should check her Google. Her phone will know she was in the classroom, by the way. You should check your location history. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
It's the next step.
There are other things that are showing she was there. The school itself can verify whether she joined their Wi-Fi. They know.
Absolutely right, because she lives in an apartment off campus.
Right, so you can say appeal to the school saying, well, I think she was there. You should have a log of her being on the Wi-Fi at that time.
Thank you. I'm doing all three of those things.
And her Google location history, does she have an iPhone? She probably has an iPhone.
She does, and she just found the location history. Somebody just told her a couple days ago.
Yeah, that will show, depends, you know, whether she's got it on and whether she used maps and stuff.
She did.
Okay.
She has maps. The whole thing.
It should show that she was there. Again, the professor may say, well, I don't care. You didn't sign the sheet.
Yeah.
What a dope.
Yes, he is.
I mean, this sounds punitive in a way that isn't very nice.
She's like such a sweet kid. Of course she
is. Yeah, of course she is. I have a college kid, too. And yeah, this kind of silly kind of officious bureaucracy is very annoying.
It is. It is.
And there's really no reason for that. He's, you know, but can he tell that she took the quiz?
Well, yeah, but so could a person. Well, you know, the quiz is actually easy to take from a remote location.
Oh.
Because everyone knows that the quiz occurs during the first 5 to 10 minutes of a class. So any dope can be sitting at home, log in.
They must have a massive problem with people not attending classes. I don't understand it.
Well, you know, it's so ironic because she actually loves to attend classes.
Yeah.
Method of learning.
Yeah.
So, and if you're sitting in a kitchen, you didn't hear the lecture. You just see the question pop up. So you don't even know the answer.
A lot of school. Henry's at CU Boulder, and I think he's in classes that do not require attendance. If you just pass the test, you're good.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, this school's different, obviously, so.
Well, this professor's different. The school, we've actually had a wonderful.
Oh, it's not the school, it's the professor.
No, it's the professor.
Yeah, you get, I understand that you get these people who are complete jerks. My wife had a professor who said, nobody gets an A in my class, I got to tell you right now. Nobody gets an A, because that would mean you know everything, and you don't.
Exactly.
And she was a straight A student, she got a C in that class, which was better than anybody else, it would have been an A, but he refused to give A's. It's like, these are little power-hungry...
I know. I can't even begin to tell you the expletives that have entered my brain, and I just keep trying to control and center
myself. You've talked to the dean at the school and so forth? He must...
She's doing everything.
You don't want a helicopter in, I understand, yeah.
Yeah, no, I don't want to get involved, other than the fact that I'm doing the background stuff so that I can direct her and
help her do it.
Try this.
This is a good learning lesson. Unfortunately, you run into people like this all the time, everywhere. They're just jerky people in the world.
You're right, and I have to remind her of that.
Yeah, and this is preparation for her life. It's a shame if she can't go to med school for 2 years because of a dopey professor. Jeez Louise. Well, I hope you resolve this. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Oh, Deborah. I know. It's hard. It's terrible. And this is part of the process for us as parents, right? Because we don't want anything. Yeah. We don't want our child to suffer.
Well, no, not sit on their hands for 2 years when
that's terrible. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Remind the dean the professor has a clear track record of clerical errors.
They do, yeah, that's right. I mean, who does a sign-in sheet?
Oh, that's dopey. Well, in college? Come on, they're grown-ups now. Come on.
That's right. I agree
come
with you.
Come on. And I don't know how they would keep you from taking the MCATs anyway.
Oh, no, it's not that she's already taken the MCATs.
Oh.
It's It's that it's hard enough to get into med school, and this mark would appear on her record for a full 2 years. And since you apply 1 year in advance,
oh,
she literally would have to wait 3 years before
crazy.
She could. Yeah, it is.
Crazy. What a system. Good luck, Deborah.
So, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And Alan in West L.A. Hello, Alan. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo. Glad you're feeling better.
I am, too. Wow.
It was miserable. What can I say?
Oh, it was awful. Yeah.
So with the WannaCry hackers, try saying that three times quickly.
WannaCry. I'll make you WannaCry.
I know that you were not happy about a certain well-known antivirus program. You thought it was bloatware and that sort of thing. That being said, is Microsoft Defender still adequate? Do you recommend an antivirus? And the sort of the B part of the question is, what about for mobile devices?
So antiviruses are not completely, useless. One piece I saw about this said that about 30% of all the antiviruses would have caught WannaCry. I'm not convinced that that's true. And this is one of the problems. Testing antiviruses is notoriously difficult because the real world is very different from some sort of lab environment. The reason I generally don't recommend antiviruses anymore is because if you get a phishing email with a file attached that you're supposed to run, most antiviruses will just go, well, you must know what you're doing, and let you run it. And if a virus keeps you from running programs, pretty soon you're going to say, I don't want this thing anymore. I can't do anything. And then there's the third problem, which is that all antiviruses have to hook themselves into the operating system at a fairly low level. And we've now heard at least three cases. Norton was one. I think Avast was the other. Where antiviruses actually became a door to open your computer to exploits. Because they were hooked in so low, the exploit attacked the antivirus, which gave them access to the operating system. So you combine those three. It's of limited use. In most cases, it's going to let you do what you want to do, even if what you want to do is dangerous. And finally, it can even make you less secure. I just have a hard time recommending them. Windows 10 comes with an antivirus, admittedly not the best antivirus. Although, again, I have to underscore, you're going to read these, Virus Bolt and other companies testing antiviruses. The problem is the suites they use to test antiviruses are well known by the antivirus manufacturers. So if an antivirus doesn't pass the test suite, they're not trying. The problem is not the test suite. The problem is the virus that was just invented yesterday and just came over the transom today. No antivirus is going to know about that. It's just too quick. So best bet is to protect yourself by updating your computer, being extraordinarily careful about what you do on the computer. Don't open attachments, especially from friends and family and companies you work with, because those are the ones that are going to be the most dangerous to you. Don't click on links without really paying attention. Here's another example, that Google Docs. Remember the Google Share that happened a couple of weeks ago where you got an email from someone you know, always from someone you know, saying, I'm sharing a Google Doc with you. Click this button. And why wouldn't you? You go, yeah, allow. And then, because it's from Aunt June, she probably wants to share in her inheritance, her will with me. Right? I'm going to be rich. So you say allow, and then it logs you into Google. Now, it does it through the legitimate Google login page, so there's no warning there. But the next page says, by the way, this Google Doc would like access to your Gmail account, would like to send and receive mail on your behalf, and would like to see all your contacts. Is that okay? Now, if you're really paying attention and you're paranoid and you're cynical, like I'm telling you to be, you might look at that and go, well, no, why would it need that? Aunt June doesn't need my emails. And you might stop. But most people just said, yeah, clicked OK. And then they've got bit because the first thing the virus did is it got all their friends' email addresses and sent the same email out to them. And so, no, the good news is Google stopped it cold in about half a day, and nobody got anything worse than that. There was no payload for some reason. It was more like an experiment. But that's the kind of thing that can happen unless you're vigilant, and no antivirus is going to stop that.
Got it. Now, is running a malware bytes on a periodic basis a wise idea just to make sure there's nothing on your machine, or it's kind of like
no.
by that time it's already too late?
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I use Windows routinely. I use, you know, I compute like crazy. I click a lot of links, but I'm kind of maybe a little bit more careful than the average bear because it would be very embarrassing for me. And I would, you know me, I would admit it. But I feel like malware bytes is a mixed blessing. And yeah, if you've got the infection, the real problem is, let's say something happens. You run malware bytes. It says, you're good. I removed it. And maybe it did remove something, but you don't know everything that's on there. What about the thing that you don't know that's on there? Now you have this false sense of security. Oh, no, I cleaned it up. And you've got a keystroke logger on there or a remote access Trojan or who knows what.
Got it. So the very last question, that if my new computer, so I'm thinking of buying a new desktop. Yes, there's a reason for me to have a desktop. If it has an antivirus installed in there, should I uninstall it or just wait till the trial ends? Or what's the best?
No, just uninstall it. A lot of computers come with McAfee. Some come with Norton. In both cases, dubious value. I immediately uninstall them because you don't want to feel like, oh, I'm safe, because you're not.
Got it.
You know, it's a false sense of security. There is something that you might want to add. If you're not running Windows 10, you should download Microsoft Security Essentials. It's their free kind of limited antivirus. And then there's something called EMET, the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit, which you can get from Microsoft that turns on something called Address Space Layout Randomization and data execution prevention. Those things are useful. Those make it harder for a bad program to work. I'm going to put a link in the show notes. Somebody in the chat room just gave me that I love. Brian Krebs is a very well-known security guy. He was at the Washington Post for years. He now runs a blog called Krebs on Security. And he's got tools for a safer PC. This does not include an antivirus. This includes his, you know, rules that are very similar to the rules I've talked about. He's worried about JavaScript, which, yeah, can be dangerous, but he recommends a plugin called NoScript that makes the web very hard to use, but if you really want to be safe, not a bad idea. He does talk about EMET, which is a very good tool. He talks about good, strong passwords, hardening your hardware. These are all recommendations from a seriously good security guy. He says antivirus software is probably the most overstated tool in any security toolbox. For years, security experts have been pitching the same advice. Install antivirus and firewall software. Some market even their products with total protection. He said he's not so crazy about it. And frankly, I don't think you should use antivirus at all.
Your advice is always gratefully appreciated, sir.
Microsoft gives you everything you need, and it's all about you and protecting yourself with your savvy. I am proud to say that I have not been bit by malware in a decade, and never on Windows. It was on a Mac when I got bit, oddly enough. And I think that's just prudence, really. And I'm a target. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We'll have more of the Best of the Tech Guy show in just a bit, but I got to tell you, our show today brought to you by, in fact, I didn't think we were going to have a sponsor for this show, but steps up to the plate, GoToWebinar. We appreciate that support, and boy, we sure appreciate GoToWebinar. I've used it for years. It's the best way to hold a webinar, you know, a seminar for the web, right? Whether it's a sales meeting, a presentation, a pitch. I've done it for educational purposes. I did one on protecting your teens online, things like that. It's a really great way for 1 to 6 people to reach a virtually infinite audience. You could do your webinar live, and live is great because there's all sorts of interactivity features with GoToWebinar. You can have present your screen, you can present an app, they can see your picture, you could take questions, you can even do polls. I'll tell you about that in a second. But one of the things I love about GoToWebinar is even if you're doing a live webinar, it's recorded and people can watch it at their convenience on demand, and it can be just as interactive. You can still do the polls, that makes it a lot of fun, and they feel like they're watching it live almost. So I want you to visit gotowebinar.com/podcast and find out more. It really is the best at 2.7 million events this year. 2.7 million events in 2017, 60 million views. That is mind-boggling. And it shows you the average event has, what, 20 viewers? Of course, they can have many more. There's virtually no limit. GoToWebinar starts by making it easy to create a webinar. You can create custom email invitations with your company logo. In fact, all the webinar material can have your company logo or whatever images you want. You can get confirmation emails sent back to you automatically so you know who's going to be there. You could send out reminders. You could do that manually, but they also have an automated email template that makes it very easy to notify people. Here it comes. You know, it's going to be in a week. Make sure you're ready. Here's what you need. The nice thing of GoToWebinar is this poll feature. I really want to talk a little bit about this. You can do in each webinar up to 20 polls. That means, and by the way, you can create them ahead of time. In fact, probably most of the time you want to, but you can. There's enough, so you can create, you know, you're not going to do 20, but let's say you do 5. There's still plenty of room to say, all right, I'm going to do a quick poll here. How many of you understood what I just talked about? Or, you know, how many of you would buy this product? Or whatever it is, you can get instant feedback from your audience, and that still works in the pre-recorded version, right? So this is really, really nice. 20 questions per survey, as I said, up to 20 polls. I highly recommend you use those because it really gets the audience involved and it gives you a lot of feedback. And by the way, that's another thing GoToWebinar does very well, the metrics. Their reporting and analytics is second to none. You're just a click away from leads, qualified leads, from metrics, and of course the data you need to improve your webinar. Next time, make it better based on feedback. And this is a great platform. Of course, encrypted, so it's private, 128-bit AES encrypted, very secure. Number one in customer satisfaction, GoToWebinar. And by the way, it's completely mobile-friendly, both for your viewers, but also for your presenters, for you. You can set up a webinar, edit a session, track performance right from your iOS or Android device. GoToWebinar.com/podcast. Turn your next presentation into a conversation with GoToWebinar. GoToWebinar, GoToWebinar.com/podcast. And we thank GoToWebinar for making our Tech Guy Best Of possible this year. Thank you, GoToWebinar. Now back to the show. Usually he joins us on the Saturday show, but we're privileged to have Johnny Jett here on a Sunday. Hello, Johnny Jett.
Hello, Leo.
He's at johnnyjett.com, a travel guru, helps us travel better with technology. You took yesterday off so you could do the travel show.
Correct. I'm here in San Diego, and I just did it. I spoke at the San Diego Travel Adventure Show at the Convention Center and spent an extra day, and now I'm here at the Hotel Del.
Oh, Cordano's. My favorite hotel in the world. I love the Del. Are you in the main building or you're in a side?
No, I'm in the side one, the Beach Village.
Yeah, I like – oh, the Beach Village. Oh, you have a suite.
Yeah, this is pretty –
The Beach Village is where the movie stars stay.
That was my presentation, how to travel like a movie star.
But, well, you're doing it.
But without movie star money.
Well, they're paying the way, so that's one way to do it. We stayed there. We spent 5 days there once and stayed in the Ocean Villas. That is so nice. It's kind of really like your little private enclave off to the side.
For sure.
Yeah. Kitchen and...
Oh, no, we don't have a kitchen.
Oh, you don't have the kitchen?
No.
Yeah, we had a little cottage. It was so much fun. And then there's a nice breakfast there and...
Yes, we had that this morning.
I love the Del. When I'm not staying in the Rockstar suite, I love to stay in the old building because it's history, right?
Yes,
and the floors sure creak. You feel like it could be haunted, but it's just so cool.
It's haunted. It is haunted.
They have the old-fashioned elevator, you know, with the in the main building with a door that, you know, opens, and I have to have an operator, guy in a bellboy suit. I think he's 100 years old. He's the sweetest guy, and he's going up, and he does the thing. You feel like you're in The Shining.
I love that. There was a place like that. I stayed in Rhode Island. Actually, you probably know it, the Ocean House in Watch Hill.
Yeah.
It used to be like that. I loved it.
Love it.
Same.
Anyway, you know, enough reminiscing.
That's right.
But tip of the hat to all our friends in San Diego. It's a great, great town.
Sure is. So one of the things that, you know, I talk about is how to get upgraded. And during my presentation. So one of the websites I recommend, it's brand new, I just learned about it, is Award Hacker. So
I like the name.
Hacker.com.
Oh, hack the awards. Wow.
So, a lot of people are now savvy enough to know that if you can pay off your credit card bills every month, you know, the best way to get miles and points is by, you know, getting certain credit cards. But again, don't get it unless you can pay it off every month. Otherwise, it's not worth it.
Yeah, I have a United card, and I just pay it every month because I don't want to pay the interest.
Yeah, I have it. I have mine on auto pay, and then I go and look at them all. Bills
and then I get lots of points that way, which is nice.
True, but a lot of times you don't know how to use them or what's the best deal. So this actually website will show you. You just put in, you know, if you're going one way, round trip, whatever city pairs, and it can be, you know, it doesn't have to be domestic. It can be international. Also, you know, if you want to make a if you're willing to make a stop or not, and which frequent flyer programs. So you can choose from 20 different programs or the four major credit cards like Amex, Chase, Citi, and Starwood. Amex.
Oh, I got them all. Yeah.
And then all the different frequent flyer programs from Air Canada all the way down to.
Now, what's this? America. This field says Hyde Off Peak Award. What does that mean?
So that is if you want to show the best deal is to get the Off Peak Award.
Okay.
But a lot of times you can't find that.
Right.
So you want to show the off. You want to show the off.
Yeah, show it, because that would be the one you really want if you can get it.
Yeah, that's the best deal.
But usually you can only get it on the third Thursday of an eighth month in the year ending with a 2.
Correct. And so, for example, I put in L.A. to JFK because I do that route often.
Yeah.
And I put it in first class. And a lot of times I would use my American miles, or at least try. And American, the cheapest you can possibly get that I've seen is 50,000 miles. But usually during peak days or when business travelers are flying, it's 130,000 miles each way.
So before you do anything, go to AwardHacker to see if you have enough miles to get this flight for free and what flights are available, because it's really hard to find, I got to say. They hide
How to use them, because these guys actually, for this route, they actually recommend using Cathay Pacific Awards for 40,000 miles for that first class.
Sneaky.
And they'll show you how to do it and what numbers to call or websites to visit. So it's a nice, handy website, and I just learned about it.
It's kind of simple. You might go there and say, well, where's the site? It's just a calculator, basically. Award Hacker. Oh, I love this. Love this, yeah. And there's no ads or anything. I don't know how they must just do it for fun.
I'm not sure on that part.
It's a free product from U.S. credit card guy.
They're probably making money through – they're probably trying to get you to buy some credit cards maybe.
Or if you book through them, you know, don't they get a little something-something if you book through them?
No, not this way they wouldn't, because you'd be calling numbers and
stuff.
Right.
All right.
So that's that one. So now I got an app for you. All right. This one is for, you know, if you're traveling this spring or summer and you're going to a foreign country, and it's always nice to, you know, learn a little bit of the local language. We talked about this once before. But this app, it's called Memrise, M-E-M-R-I-S-E.
Okay.
And they actually try to make a game out of it to make it more fun. I think they're going after the millennials.
They say learning made joyful.
Yes.
Oh, and it's joyful.
And it's free for Android and iOS.
So now the king of this, the free language learning apps, is Duolingo, right?
Correct.
How does this compare to Duolingo?
You know, this one's a little bit different because they make it out of a game.
Fun.
And so you're supposed to be a spy. And so you're trying to learn this. You're trying to learn these skills, and you know, I just did it last week, and I quickly learned. You know, I brushed up on my Italian, and so you learn like 3 or 4 words within 5 minutes. But they keep drilling it into you, and then they even email you. And so you're supposed to do a little bit every day, and you can learn from you know, French, Spanish, and Spanish. You know, they're even talking about Mexican Spanish or Spanish,
right?
German, English, Mandarin. Japanese, Korean, nice. Turkish. They have a whole.
I want to do this. This is great. Memrise. Memrise.com. But it's iOS or Android, so you can correct. Also search for it on your app store.
And the goal is to learn 5 new words a day with them. And I did it within a few minutes. I didn't do it the next day, but they emailed me and said, hey, where are you? You know, you forgot to log on. Or 2 days later, they emailed me.
Paige in our chat room says, I love Memrise, and I'm learning Spanish, and it's so easy.
Oh, good.
So you found something cool. Ooh, I love this. I'm going to make a note of that one. Because I really love, even if you just say a few words in a language when you're visiting a country, it just changes the whole complexion of the conversation. Because you've made the effort.
Especially in France, if you go into a shop and you don't say bonjour, they you're rude. Or say goodbye, you know, bonsoir.
Yeah, and I always say madame or monsieur. Because you want to be very polite. They're very polite, formal people. And it does. It works wonders.
Right.
And by the way, speaking of wonders, I see a little wonder behind you.
Oh, Natalie, you see
Natalie
Jack?
And Jack. Yeah, I'm looking at – we're seeing Johnny on Skype video so I can see him. Oh, Is he enjoying his first visit to the Hotel Del?
Oh, he is. First time to San Diego.
That kid is spoiled. Oh, hey, Jack. Oh, is he precious? Oh,
yes,
hi,
he
Natalie.
Is.
Great to see you. Yeah.
So I got one tip. We have time for
a tip. We got time for a tip.
Okay, so I'm always trying to give you a tip every week. So this time, if there's ever a big major snowstorm or a volcano and you cannot get through to the airline's customer service desk, and I had a buddy call me up 2 weeks ago, said he couldn't get through to United for 2 hours, and do I have a secret number? I was like, no. But what you should do is jump on Skype and call their one of their international numbers. So call the Australian United Airlines number. And he texted me back and said that worked.
Oh,
like
that's clever.
It took me two minutes, and I got it.
And they don't mind. They don't say, hey, mate, what are you calling me for?
No. I mean, they might, but, you know.
Who cares? I need help. That's why. I can't get those other people.
You know, they shouldn't be putting you on hold for 2 hours.
Right.
So, you know, try different call centers.
Nice.
It won't work for small airlines like Southwest or Virgin America, who don't have offices around the world, but for United, Delta, and American, for sure.
You'll find more at johnnyjet.com. That's his website. Follow him on Twitter, at johnnyjet, on Instagram, at johnnyjet. And if he ever comes to town, you can learn to travel like a movie star. Thank you, Johnny.
Thank you.
Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We go back to the phones, and it looks like I got Frank on the line next from Tullahoma, Tennessee. Hello, Frank.
Well, hi, Leo.
How are you?
Talk to you.
Nice to talk to you.
You've been saving me for the last, ever since ZDTV days.
Oh, yeah, the good old days. Screensavers, for help.
Back when I was a retired aerospace engineer trying to learn about PCs.
Nice. Did you?
Oh, yeah. I spent the next 10 or 15 years as just a consultant, but you got me off from mainframes to PCs.
Oh, that's great. I'm thrilled to hear it, Frank. Thank you for
really
watching.
Useful.
Thank you.
Yeah, I got a minor little problem now that I hope you can help me with.
Well, I'll do my best.
I've got my new Windows 10 computer's screen is almost unreadable.
Oh, you know why they use these screens now are very, what we call high DPI, high dots per inch, or very high res.
Yeah, but the slight blue text on white screen.
Oh, it's a color issue.
Oh, sure, but these ancient eyes have trouble.
It's not the size of the text, it's the contrast.
Yeah, you know, I can always up the screen, you know, zoom in.
Well, I was going to tell you about that. Yeah, okay, good. All right. So there is, now I don't know, this might be too much contrast. But in the accessibility mode, there is a high contrast theme. And the nice thing about it is you can turn it on or off at will. So you don't have to leave it on all the time. But if you're having trouble reading some text in particular, you can choose the high contrast theme. You can turn it off with, get ready for this, left shift plus left alt right next to it. Plus print screen.
Yeah, well, if you got that many thumbs.
Yeah, you need, well, three will do. So there's two on the left shift and left alt, and then the print screen depends on your computer where it is, but usually it's kind of the upper right. So it's like the three-finger salute, but instead of Control-Alt-Delete, left shift, left alt, and print screen, and that'll just turn it on temporarily. Now, if you like it and you want to keep it on, you can change that in the settings. You just go into the, you know, right click on the desktop, say personalize, choose the theme you like, and then turn on high contrast mode, and that'll make it permanent. And that is exactly why they do that. It's part of, it's for people who, you know, these young people today, they love the light gray text on the kind of the darker gray background. You can't read it.
That's invisible.
It's invisible. They make the print too small, and then they make it too low contrast. So this is exactly why Microsoft does this.
Yeah, when us guys that do mostly writing, and we got to read the text, not the pretty screen.
Right. It's pretty doesn't count. You need, yeah. So this is an accessibility, or as Microsoft calls it, an ease of access setting. You can actually turn it on. Like, even before you get, you know, even during sign-on, when you go to the sign-on, you know, in the lower right, there's like a little, it's the ease of access button. It's, I don't know, looks like a wheelchair or something. But you can click that and choose high contrast. That'll make it easier to sign on to. So this is all for people who, of a certain age, like you and me, who can't read those screens as well as we used to.
You'd think at Microsoft, I think they didn't have what they call a usability.
Oh, they do. They like do. That. Oh, no, they do. And it's and it honestly, it is sometimes designers, I think, well, first of all, they're young. They got young eyes. But I think also sometimes they favor form over function, you know? Was it Frank Lloyd Wright who said form should follow function? That the idea of a design is functionality should inform the designer, the designer, what it should look like. And I think sometimes designers forget that and they care about how it looks more than how it works. So the good news is the other side of Microsoft, across the aisle from the designers, there's a very good accessibility team that is totally devoted to making Windows easier to use for people who have all kinds of accessibility issues. And so Microsoft, Apple does this too. In fact, some might say even does even a better job. But Microsoft has a very active, I remember talking to the advocate. There was a woman whose sole job across the whole company was to be an advocate, to go into every division and say, now let me see your accessibility plans. How accessible is this going to be? And contrast is a big one. All phones now will do this. Tablets will do it. And yes, Windows 10 will do it. Turn on high contrast mode. And that will really help you with that low contrast text. I really like it. I think this is a nice feature that they make it that you can toggle it. Because I don't know if I would want to operate in high contrast mode all the time. But left shift, left alt, plus print screen turns it on. Left shift, left alt, plus print screen turns it off. Ad hoc, as needed. Nice to talk to you. I'm glad things are going well for you in Tullahoma. Thank you, Frank. Jeff, Apple Valley. I think you might be the last call of the day. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
Well, thank you, Leo. I'm glad I'm the last call of the day and got this in.
Good.
I'm having
too.
A very strange problem with my search engines on my computer. You go to the search. Well, actually, you just turn them on, and suddenly all the search bar fills in with is left bracket, left bracket, left bracket, every now and then a apostrophe, and it fills the entire search bar and keeps on going and keeps on moving.
And that doesn't happen if you have a word processor document open? That doesn't happen?
Nothing.
Nowhere else? Because, you know, obviously the first thing I think is, oh, you got a stuck key or a zapped keyboard and it's typing. But it's only happening on the browser.
It's only happening on the browser.
Yeah. It does. Some, Dr. Mom in our chat room says, sounds like when my cat walks on the keyboard. You don't have any cats, do you?
No.
No, this is a browser problem. What browser are you using?
Well, it happens on both of them, as a matter of fact.
Oh, that's interesting. All right.
I've got Mozilla, and I have both the Edge browser, of course, on this particular.
You know, if you got Windows 10, which you do, for grins. You also have, though they hide it, Internet Explorer on there.
I do indeed. Let's see if I can. You know,
yeah.
Where
just
it is?
So you just, yeah. Well, all you have to do is hit the Windows key and start typing Internet, and it'll populate Internet Explorer at some point and hit return. Windows key, and you start typing the program you want to launch. That's a really nice shortcut in Windows. And I'm just curious if it happens in Internet Explorer as well.
Well, we have another problem now. I went to the Windows key, hit it. It opened up, and suddenly in the search engine, it just starts doing the same thing. I can't get to the program.
Oh, very interesting. So that's really interesting. So now if you hit Windows key, it starts typing brace, colon, brace, colon, brace, colon, brace, colon as well.
Exactly.
Oh, wow. But not in any other, like you open Notepad and you click the cursor and you start typing, it types normally.
Time I can't even get to Notepad. I'm trying to see if I have something else on my open up right now that I potentially can get to that I can write something on.
First thing I would do is is it a laptop or desktop?
It's a desktop.
Just unplug the keyboard and see. And do you have any other keyboards lying around?
Yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, somewhere around here.
I would just plug in a different keyboard just to really eliminate that as a culprit.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, just because it does sound like, if that, by the way, if it continues to happen with the other keyboard, then there is something on your machine. See, the thing is, if it just happened in the browser or one browser, I would say, oh, yeah, you got a browser hijacker object that's poorly written, it's crashing, or something's going on. Something was, you know, and these things are easy to pick up by accident. You can install some software, and they'll have a little fine print that says, oh, and by the way, we're going to install the fabulous browser hijacker toolbar. You don't mind, do you? And you just don't even notice it, and it's installed. It happens to everybody. Sometimes that could cause it. But the fact that it's happening not just on your browsers, but now it's happening with Cortana, but this is something serious. Something serious, and hard for me to diagnose. Check with another keyboard. If it continues to happen, boy, you got me. I think might be called for reinstalling Windows. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Michelle on the line from Northridge, California. Hi, Michelle. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello. Nice to talk with you.
Nice to talk to you.
Okay, my question is, what's the difference between the old hard drive style and the new SSD for Mac, and which do you prefer?
Well, there's a big difference. In fact, I just I pulled off of my shelf a old hard drive. This is a really old hard drive, but all spinning hard drives are kind of basically the same. Randy Bilder made a clock out of mine, which is kind of funny. But they're kind of like record players, except instead of vinyl, the old hard drives have spinning metal plates. Sometimes they're glass, and they're magnetic, so they can be magnetized. And then the old hard drives had what we call read heads, one per platter. And hard drives today might have multiple platters, one per platter. Those read heads are just like the needle on a record player, except instead of reading the grooves, they're reading the magnetic signals coming off the spinning platter. So it's kind of like a record player meets cassette recorder. And of course, because it's a computer, everything's recorded as ones or zeros. That's just the way computers work, on or off. And so it's very easy in a magnetic material to have a charge or no charge. And actually, it's a little different than that, but that's roughly how it would work. And so the platters spin very fast. On spinning hard drives, the slowest ones are 5,400 revolutions a minute. The fastest ones, 10,000, almost twice as fast revolutions a minute. And those little heads, the needle on the record player, move very quickly. They have a motor called an actuator. You can even hear it if you have an old-fashioned hard drive spinning. And as the spinning is going on, the spinning is, and you can hear the heads going as the actuator motor moves the heads around. The problem with that setup, besides the fact that there's a lot of moving parts that could easily be damaged if you drop a hard drive or damaged in other ways by magnetic materials and so forth, the other problem with it is physics. The spinning and the moving of the heads take time. For instance, if you think about it, as the hard drive is spinning, even at 10,000 revolutions per minute, the head goes in, reads some sector, and then it has to wait for the hard drive to come all the way around to read the next one, and the next one, and the next one. So they call that seek time. That's how long it takes the head to move to the place you need. And that can be a significant amount of time. I mean, not in human terms, but for a computer, it could be milliseconds. So solid-state drives work a little differently. Instead of having any physically moving parts, they have little cells that can be electrically charged. It's almost identical to the stuff you put in your camera, you know, the memory card you put in your camera or an SD card. That's basically what a solid-state drive is. And it has some real advantages. Nothing's spinning, nothing's moving, so they're more reliable. You can drop one, there's nothing going to break, unless you really drop it and break the physical material. But also, there's no seek time because it seeks at the speed of light. It can find data anywhere inside that solid-state drive just by jumping to it. So it really reduces the amount of time to get the data considerably, so much so that solid-state drives read data 10 and 20 and even more, 100 times faster than a spinning drive. They write data a little bit more slowly because writing data involves charging those cells, and that takes a little bit of time. But it's still, overall, significantly faster and more reliable than a spinning hard drive. So I think that you – does that answer your question? That's kind of the long answer. Yeah.
You know, I wanted a long answer. I was trying to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah.
And that answered my question, yes.
So having a, nowadays, I think most computers come with solid state drives. Having a solid state drive really does make a big difference. The overall speed of your computer is measured at, really in many different ways. So a lot of times we talk about, well, I have a 4 gigahertz processor. Well, that's just one part of it. A really fast processor, the brain of the computer, often spending time waiting for the hard drive or even RAM memory, the place where stuff is stored on its way to the processor. It's certainly waiting for you. If you're using a computer to type, the amount of time between one key and the other, even if you're a 90-word per minute typist or 100-word or 200, if you were a 200-word a minute typist, would be an eon for a computer. A computer's just going, come on, next key, next, I'm waiting. I'm sitting here, I'm waiting. All right, next question.
Okay. I've been doing what you said and trying to back up my photos.
Good.
Three different places. And so...
Nice. Thank you, yeah, Michelle. Good.
I was doing it to the USB thumb drive. And now I was looking at the new Macs, and they have a new, is it called Thunderbolt?
Yeah.
Thunderbolt.
Yeah.
So if I got a new computer in a few years, the drives I'm putting my pictures on...
You're going to be fine because those new Thunderbolt ports, that they call them Type-C ports... You just take an adapter and you put it on that old USB key. So it's not a problem. I do it all the time now because I have lots of machines with these little thin Thunderbolt 3 ports. They don't look the same, and you wouldn't want to try to shove a thumb drive into one of those ports. But but it's easy for a buck. You can get an adapter that will just take the old Thunderbolt. Now, I do caution you. Thumb drives are notoriously unreliable, okay? They die over time. Anybody who's used thumb drives for this kind of purpose, eventually. So it's good because you have three copies. So if one dies, not the end of the world. But you might want to look, and they're not very expensive, invest in an external hard drive. Those tend to be more reliable than thumb drives.
Yeah, that's one of the places that I have them.
Good. Yeah, and then remember, we want three copies, but we also want to get one off-site. Take one to work. So what you can do is you can rotate them every week, on Monday when you go into work, take one of the drives to work and just rotate them. And that way you'll always have one off site, and that's really important.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you, Michelle.
Nice to talk to you.
I love those questions, and I think sometimes people have said, well, I don't want to sound dumb. I'm not going to ask them the difference between a spinning drive and an SSD, whatever. But I think that's something a lot of people don't know, and it's a useful thing to understand. And it helps you understand why an SSD might be a better choice for you. But I guess what I was getting to is any one component doesn't speed up. I mean, it's all the components together. It's a holistic unit that make a computer fast or slow. So if you have a slow computer, sometimes putting in an SSD will make it should make it faster, but not always. Depends on other components in that computer. But generally speaking, it's important to consider everything. And one thing people often don't consider is the speed of disk reads and writes. That's one of the things your computer spends a long time waiting for. It's one of the reasons we often tell people if you're going to buy a new computer these days, you probably want an SSD. There was some concern initially that they may not be as reliable, that they might wear out faster. But I think now that we've been using them for some time, I don't think that that's the case. I think we're all pretty comfortable with the fact that they're at least as reliable as spinning drives. 8888 Ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. More calls right after this. He plays a mighty mouth harp. That's Dick DiBartolo, Mad Magazine's maddest writer and harmonica player.
Yeah.
Dick DiBartolo. Wow, he can even talk while he's playing the harmonica. It's amazing.
I have a man of many talents.
Doesn't the big bushy mustache kind of get, in the way?
A little bit.
It's all right. You can have a little hair in your harmonica. Dick also, besides being Mad's maddest writer and a brilliant humorist and the author of Good Days and Mad, which everybody should run to the bookstore and buy. He is also a gadget hound, and each week he joins us with gadgets. I hope you have... Did you hear my discussion before during the break?
Yes, and I'm thinking, if I had only done this 2 weeks earlier, this would have solved all of your problems.
So, Lisa, my wife and I we're going on a trip. We've got to get different adapters. We want. Yeah. I said I would like tonight, as we're packing, to lay out all the electronics. There's dozens, and plug in the cable each one needs, and make sure I have a plug, socket, and adapter for everything. And it's crazy. And I know you could solve this.
Yes, Leo. If this is for your trip after this trip.
Because it's too late now. In other words, you're going to tell me something that I can't use.
It's too late now, okay? All you needed, and you don't have to worry about security, was one. Well, actually, they have a sale on a pair of them, so you and Lisa could each have one. A clip-a-phone.
Clip-a-phone?
Okay? A clip-a-phone. Not only will this help you with your photographing, but whenever Lisa says, like, Leo, where's your phone? You say, Lisa, it's on my head.
Okay. That doesn't look dorky at all.
No. So this is it. A lot of museums and amusement parks are outlawing selfie sticks.
Yeah. Rightly so.
So now you click your phone to your head. Okay.
Yeah.
It goes on a baseball cap. They will actually they have a special where they will sell you two clips with baseball caps.
Yeah.
And then a little Bluetooth adapter that comes on a lanyard or a keychain.
Yeah.
And then you press once to shoot a photograph, press it quickly twice to start video.
Oh.
And as they said, your body is a perfect tripod. And anywhere you look, you are aiming at what you want to film.
What the what?
Yeah, right? Because you don't have to bother. You know, someone says, look over there. You don't have to bother getting your camera, because as soon as you turn your head, your camera's facing.
Now, can I ask you, have you worn this thing? Doesn't it make your hat kind of lopsided?
No, it doesn't. I do know from using the Galaxy in it that the Galaxy just fits. So it's not going to fit the new big phones.
And you weren't humiliated wearing this around? People didn't...
No, because, quite frankly, I did it in the backyard.
Yeah, that's what I would do, too. So it works on any baseball hat. You have to clip it onto the bill.
Exactly. And you have to have not one of the new giant phones. And it comes with the little Bluetooth
button
device to set it off.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I found on the Galaxy, every time I clicked a photograph, that was absolutely perfect. But for some reason, trying to get it to go into video mode was a little bit wonky on the Galaxy. That's the only phone I tried it on. But I told the guy, and he said we have lots of people with Galaxies using it, so they weren't quite sure. Chris.
I got your wrong lower third. Well, you're not Chris. Because you are a photographer.
I was just going to say, this is such profound professional photography advice. I can totally understand.
It's our photo segment now. And But, you know, a lot of times you buy something like this, $29.99 for two clips, and they say, hat not included. But in this case.
Now they're giving you the hat.
Hat is included. It's just a gray or a black cap. But, you know, you don't have to go out and buy a cap.
No, there you go.
Actually, wait a minute. It's not even $19.99 plus shipping and handling. Oh, it's $10 shipping and handling. There you go.
Oh, is it? Okay. Yeah.
Well, it says $29.99.
Right.
And then it says only $19.99 plus shipping and handling. So I guess it's $10 shipping and handling.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. As seen on the GizWiz show.
That's so funny.
Yeah, they gave you a little plug.
Oh, my gosh, I didn't even see that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's nice. And then there's an app, the Cap Clip-a-Phone app.
App, exactly. And, nice. You know, you wouldn't have to lay out the cable. All you do, you say, Lisa, let's lay out the two caps. Where's your Clip-a-Phone?
There's just two more things I got to bring. Yeah, I thought this time, because every time we go on a trip, there's always... Well, you didn't bring the charger? I thought you brought the charger. Well, do you have a lightning cable? No, I don't have any lightning cables. I'm using them. And we end up like doubling up. Like, okay, you're done charging your phone because it's my turn. And I just want to have enough.
You're doing it in a very systematic way.
I thought we'd lay out all the electronics, plug in a cable to each of them, then make sure that there is a USB port, because I'm bringing with me like power strips with their own USB ports and stuff like that. I don't know. It's still going to end up.
I want to just remind you. You did this 2 years ago, and the ship had sailed 2 days.
Yeah,
and you were still saying, yeah. "Lisa, do you have the lightning cable?" Or
caramba.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great fun.
Oh, it's going to be fun.
I know you've set up a website for us to follow
you. You saw that. Blog, leolaporte.com. I've been looking at different ways to do this, and for a while I looked at photos, Google Photos, but Microsoft makes this thing called Sway. I don't know. We'll see how this works because I have, as you know, when you're traveling, often limited bandwidth. But what I'd like to do is take at least one good picture a day and put it on my Sway, and I've already embedded it on the blog. So I think I've played with it. If I just put some pictures in the Sway, it'll automatically update on the blog.
Yeah. You're not bringing a micro tower?
Well, yeah. Okay. And a couple of 27-inch screens. I think that'll be okay.
I think it's going to be fine. Yeah. I think security is going to have no problem with that.
You'll find more Dick at gizwiz.biz, gizwiz.biz. Of course, click the link that says the Gizwiz visits the tech guy for more information about the Clipophone. And if you go, while you're there, if you go to the What the Heck Is It contest, you get a chance to take a picture or take look at a picture of a close-up of a gadget and figure out what the heck it is. It's 12 autographed Mad magazines. I have one right here just to... When I won back in 2016, 12 autographed copies of Mad Magazine for the best right answer and 24th for the best wrong answer.
And a preview of the August issue that you'll be playing for.
Oh, it's all there, gizwiz.biz. And Dick does a great weekly podcast with Chad Johnson called The Weekly Gizwiz, and you'll find that at gizwiz.tv. Thank you, Dickie D.
Thank you, sir.
I'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Safe time. Okay.
Moving on, let's go to Michael, Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hello, Michael.
Hi, Leo.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Long-time listener.
Thank you.
First caller.
Wonderful. Welcome.
I've always wondered, and I couldn't never find anything online that would tell me a definite answer. Maybe you know.
All right.
Internet is just our computers talking to every computer around,
right? This is a great question. You know, most people wouldn't admit, you know, because we all use internet all the time. But yeah, well, what is it? When engineers write, you know, diagram it, they write a puffy little cloud. That's why we sometimes call it a cloud, because they don't really want to explain what it is. So it's a great question. The internet sometimes is called the network of networks. Oh, that makes things clear. What it is exactly what you described. It's just a bunch of computers that can talk to one another.
So how come we pay these internet providers to let me talk to your computer?
Well, that's a great question,
too.
They're providing the road. So you're basically paying a toll for the road. Somebody has to build the road and maintain the road. And there are a number of people who do that. The internet has big backbones across the U.S. They have undersea cables in between continents. Those have all been put down. Those backbones are usually fiber optic cables or high capacity. Originally, they were put down by the phone companies, Sprint, AT&T. Big companies, lots of money because they have to... You know, I mean, imagine a cable reaching from San Francisco to New York. That's a backbone. And they have to be not just, you know, small cables. They're going to carry a lot of traffic. That's why they use glass fiber optics, because fiber optics can carry huge amounts of data in a very tiny space at the speed of light. So these are the backbones. And then there are what we call interconnects. The interconnects are big hubs. If you think of the backbones as kind of the interstate freeway, the interconnects are the hubs, the interchanges, where other people plug into those backbones. So, for instance, there's a hub, a interconnect in San Francisco, May West, it's called. And internet service providers connect up to that hub. They pay for the wires that go from your house to the hub. And you pay them to maintain those wires. They pay AT&T and Sprint for access to the backbone. So some of the money that you pay to your internet service provider is then passed along to the people who maintain the backbone and the undersea cables and the hubs and everybody else. So you're, in effect, paying for the maintenance and operation of the internet. And everybody does that. It's one of the reasons that the whole notion of net neutrality has become so important, because some of the companies like Verizon, Comcast, which is the biggest internet service provider in the country, and AT&T, think that it's unfair that you should only pay them once. They say, but what about all that data that we're bringing to you? You're paying us to get on the internet, but what about Google? Google's not paying us for access to you. Netflix isn't paying us. We want to charge them too. They want to double dip. They want to say, Netflix, if you would like to talk to Michael in Grand Rapids, you're going to have to pay us a little bit extra too. Now, that's not in the spirit of the internet. That's not how the internet was created. They make plenty of money, believe me. Have you seen your internet bill lately? They make plenty of money off of you and all the customers. And all they're really doing is maintaining the lines. They've already spent the money to put the lines in. They're just maintaining them, keeping them running. It's not hugely expensive. It's very profitable. They just want to make it more profitable. And by doing so, and this is why it's a problem, they get to choose winners and losers. You know, I stream all of my shows via audio and video to anybody anywhere in the world that wants to listen to them absolutely free. I'm kind of like an internet radio station. This is my TWIT podcast network, TWIT.TV. Comcast, if it weren't for net neutrality regulations, could say, hey, Leo, Netflix pays us for access to Michael. You ought to pay us for access to Michael. I pay my internet service charges. I pay a lot of money to get on the internet, but I shouldn't have to pay to get to you. A toll road, they call it the toll road for the last mile. And many internet service providers want to do this. They want to do it badly because there's a lot of money to be made. And it's in the interest of the United States, of all of us, in the interest of innovation and growth, that they not be allowed to do that. However, I should point out, the current FCC and the new chairman, Ajit Pai of the FCC, have shown very little interest in protecting customers, much more interest in protecting those big internet service providers and their chance to make big profits. And because we don't really have much choice, most of us have one or two internet service providers in our neck of the woods, broadband providers anyway, there's not much we can do about it. You know, we should write to the FCC, write to a member of Congress and say, please protect the free and open internet. Don't let these big companies take us for a ride. It's not good for us. And more importantly, it's not good for the nation. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox. But that's, Michael, that's in an essence, you got it right. These are all computers connected via a network. What you're paying for is that network, the wires, in effect, that are connecting us.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. See, I just never understood.
No. We just use it, right? But I think it's important to understand how it works. And really important to understand how it works so we can defend it from people who would like to make a lot of money out of it.
And I've heard you talk about net neutrality a lot of times, and that's funny you bring that up because I was just telling people at work how important that is.
Mm-hmm.
So I could not give them a website off the top of my head.
It's hard to explain.
Where we could go to tell people we don't want or we want that, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'll give you a website that you can read about this and find out more about what's going on and the fight to preserve internet freedom.
So do we want net neutrality or
yes,
not?
Yes, we do.
What side is the good part?
That's a good question.
Good part. Okay.
And part of the problem is that's a terrible term, right? Net neutrality. What does that mean? What we want is we don't want discrimination on the internet. We don't want internet service providers to be able to charge a toll so that Netflix or YouTube can get to you. They already charge you. They want to charge the other end as well. And that's bad for the internet. So net neutrality protects that, saying that all bits are equal. Once a bit pays to get on the internet, it should be able to go to everyone freely and without additional charge. All bits are equal. SaveTheInternet.com. SaveTheInternet.com is the website that you can go to find out what net neutrality is, why it's important, and most importantly, there's a button on there that'll help you write to your member of Congress. We're going to have to go to Congress to defend internet neutrality at this point. The administration and the FCC have been very clear that they're on the sides of Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon, and not on the sides of us as users. So we're going to have to take the fight to Congress. Congress tells the FCC what to do, and we're going to have to make sure they do. So SaveTheInternet.com. Find out more. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Well, I'm going to go with the call that made me laugh the most.
That sounds good. Thank you, Kim.
Dina in Manhattan Beach wants a app where she can track her husband from her iPhone to his Samsung phone. But he knows about it, so I guess it's not...
Hey, that's fair.
But if you don't know the answer, a friend of mine is doing this with her daughter, so...
Yeah, there's lots of ways.
There's probably lots of ways, so I have the name of one app.
What's that?
Life 360, I heard.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that, yeah.
She's got a Samsung, her daughter's got an iPhone.
That's a good one, yeah. Thank you, Kim. Let's say hi to Dina in Manhattan Beach. Hi, Dina. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, how are you?
I'm wonderful. So you want to track your husband, huh?
Yeah, I track my son and my dogs. So I wanted to track my
So if you think about it, a smartphone is basically made to be a tracker. Because what do we have in here? We have an always-on internet connection. We have a GPS radio, which will tell you where the phone is within 3 meters. Uh-huh. I mean, this thing is not only that. I mean, it's got a camera, microphone, and speaker. I mean, this thing is the ultimate spy device. So, of course, you should have the permission of the person you're following. And if you do have their permission, it's a lot easier to keep track of them.
Oh, even if I didn't have permission, I still would do it.
Yeah, yeah. So there's software on there. Obviously, you're familiar. It sounds like you might do this even with your kids with Find My Friends on the iPhone. And
I have Find My Friend, and I have 360 on my son's iPhone.
Okay. So those
I don't have it on my husband's phone because I couldn't get it to... Find My Friends only for Apple, so I wanted to do something else so we can all know where my son is, basically, so we can both track our son.
I do really like this idea. I don't know if you read the Harry Potter books, but in one of the books, there's a family that has a clock, but instead of showing the time, it shows the location of every member of the family. And when Dad comes home from work, the big hand goes from work to home and things like that. It's just a really cool idea. And absolutely there are ways to do this. Google Maps, for instance, will let you share your location. And everybody has Google Maps. So this works completely cross-platform. But it does require the cooperation of the person you're tracking. So they can open the Google Map, tap the blue dot that shows where you are, and then the menu that pops up, one of the items in the menu will be share location, and you can say, share this with Mom and how long. It does time out after a while. But you can, if you wish, say until I turn it off. And then that will be kind of permanent sharing. And then what you'll have is kind of like that clock. By the way, this is free, and it, again, completely cross-platform. It'll work on any device, including a tablet. As long as it has GPS in it or some sort of form of location finding. And then what you'll get is like that Harry Potter clock, your Google Map from now on will have an icon showing you where people are. So I think that's a really cool idea. It's like actually more like maybe if we're going to stick with the Harry Potter thing. Remember that map that they found that showed everybody's location in Hogwarts, the Marauders map? It's kind of more like that. So to my understanding, that can be left on permanently. Although, again, my suspicion is it will time out. So your husband or your son will have to turn that on from time to time. I'm sure there are other... Is Life 360 only on the iPhone? That would be kind of... That's the same idea. Let me just check here. The idea is that it does crash detection, emergency response, but it also lets you know where everybody is. No, iPhone and Android. So it is on Android as well. So that would be even kind of maybe a better idea because it's really designed to do exactly what you want to do, keep track of everybody in the family. The app is free. I would not be surprised if there is some in-app purchase at some point. But it will show you, it gives you alerts when members of your family circle get to the school or get to work. You know, Joey arrived at school, Joey arrived at work. It'll have distracted driving details. So if you have teenagers who are driving, that's really great. This seems like, thank you, Kim. This seems like exactly the program for this. Invite only. Only circle members can see each other's members and locations. And that's important because, after all, you know, this could be invasive if you don't have permission. I mean, maybe free. I don't now that if it is free, then that makes me nervous because that means they're using, you know, nothing's free. If you don't pay money for it, then there's some way that they're, unless they're, you know, great benefactors of humanity, there's some way they're making money on this. It costs money to do something like this. They may be collecting information about your location and selling it, that kind of thing. I'll look into this in more detail. In fact, I think I'll install it. This is a great idea. It also for new drivers. It's life360.com. Ah, it does have some paid option. Thank you, Evil Bob, in the chat room. He said it's not free. There's some paid options. You know what? That makes me feel better. I want it to be paid a little bit. That's better. George on the line from Santa Monica, California. Hi, George.
Oh, good afternoon, Leo. I want to butter you up.
Oh, please.
Before I ask my question, I want to thank you for your talent for everybody is to take technical problems and breaking it down to where the average guy can understand it.
Well, because I'm an average guy. If I don't break it down, I won't understand it.
You're not an average guy. Now, my question now.
Thank you.
Can you explain about Bitcoins?
Oh, Lord. This is a good one. No, it's a great question.
They've been going since like 2009. And I know the price of a Bitcoin now is up to $4,000.
Can you believe it?
What gives it that value?
Nothing.
I don't understand them. I know.
Belief. So, this is a great question. I love it. And I'm going to see if I can do this. I have 8 minutes to explain what Bitcoin is, which is not nearly enough. It's a category of money we call cryptocurrencies, and there are a lot of them now. There's Ethereum is the latest, but Bitcoin is probably the best known. So to understand Bitcoin, you need to step back a little bit and understand what money is. You know, we always think about money as, U.S. greenbacks, Federal Reserve notes, pieces of paper or pieces of metal with a e pluribus unum, you know, and the paint, you know, printed on them and backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. But really, that piece of paper isn't worth anything, is it? It's just a piece of paper. Even a quarter is not worth 25 cents. So what that is, in fact, all currencies are something called fiat currency from the Latin word fiat, which I think means let there be or let it be. Really, those are faith-based currencies. They are valued at a dollar bill's valued at a dollar, not because that piece of paper is worth a dollar, not even because it's backed up by a dollar's worth of gold or silver anywhere, but just because the U.S. government says that's what it's worth. And you can pay your taxes with it. But even what the value of a dollar changes, it's become less valuable over time, hasn't it? Over, you know, a dollar used to be able to buy you a three-piece suit and a hat with two pairs of pants. Now, you know, you'd be lucky if you get a cup of coffee with a dollar. That's just inflation over time. So even the actual value of a dollar has changed. Sometimes people say, well, yeah, if we had the gold standard, the silver standard, it'd be worth, then we'd know what it's worth. But the truth is, people don't like when you say this, but even gold's a fiat currency. The industrial value of an ounce of gold sure as heck isn't worth thousands of dollars. It's valued at that, you know, just kind of magically. We don't talk about this because the faith in money is pretty important to keeping money sensible. But anybody who lived through a hyperinflation has happened in Zimbabwe, has happened in the Weimar Republic before World War I, knows that, you know, suddenly those pieces of paper aren't aren't even worth a piece of paper anymore. So we think that U.S. money is somehow magical, or dollars are somehow magical, but they're faith-based as well. They're fiat currency as well. So the value of a Bitcoin is kind of similar. It's just, it's worth what people say it's worth. We always interpret it in terms of government currencies like dollars, and that changes. Bitcoin was invented by a mysterious person or persons using the handle Satoshi Nakamoto. It's a Japanese name, and you might assume there's a person named that, but we don't. Nobody's ever been able to successfully find that person. Some people even think he might even be dead, and others say, well, it's not one person, it's many. But whoever it was a mathematical genius and came up with a way, a very clever way, of creating a currency that's based on math and hard math problems. And he set it up in such a way that Bitcoins would be mined, created, brought out of nothing by computers solving difficult math problems. He even set it up in such a way that as more Bitcoin was mined, it would be more difficult to mine it. He did it so cleverly that, in fact, it's roughly equivalent to the cost of the power needed to power the computer. So it's hard to make money Bitcoin mining unless you can get very cheap electricity. In fact, most people who are mining Bitcoins are in China near power plants where they get effectively free energy. Those people are making money, those Bitcoin miners. In fact, they're the real power behind Bitcoin, the people generating it. The database, the ledger of Bitcoin is called the blockchain. And when you install a Bitcoin wallet, you download the entire blockchain, more than 100 gigabytes now of data, that has every transaction ever made in Bitcoin, and will continue to grow as more transactions are made. So it's a completely distributed system. There's no central bank. There's no company. It's just a group of users who are generating Bitcoin, solving mathematical problems, kind of magically creating it. Bitcoin will be limited, by the way, to avoid inflation. There will be a total number of Bitcoins created. I think it's by 2020 that we won't see any new Bitcoins being created. There'll just be a pool of Bitcoins. And then they can be used by people trading them. And they're really, their value is just by what people say. So in the early days of Bitcoin, somebody bought a pizza. I think he spent 20 or 30 Bitcoins to buy the pizza. It would have been what is it now? Hundreds of thousands of dollars for that pizza had he held the coins. The value's gone up and down just like any stock, just like any market. But it's been trending up lately for a variety of reasons, mostly having to do with news. I think it's very interesting. Governments don't generally recognize Bitcoin one way or the other. You can't pay your taxes in Bitcoin. But there are plenty of exchanges out there that will exchange Bitcoin for real money. You can go to Coinbase and get dollars for your Bitcoins. Trade them in. Where are your Bitcoins? Well, they're nowhere. They're just bits. You store them in a Bitcoin wallet on your computer or on a service like Coinbase, with a top-secret encrypted password. Your Bitcoin address is a long number. You can make multiple Bitcoin addresses. People can send you number Bitcoin at that address, which gives you some anonymity. That's why Bitcoin's widely used by ransomware hackers, who will give you a Bitcoin address, say, transfer Bitcoin to this address. You open up your wallet, and wallets have a way of sending Bitcoin. You type in the address you're sending it to and how much you're sending. That gets transferred into their Bitcoin address. It's not completely anonymous because that number is available. So we can always see how much money has been transferred into any Bitcoin address because we all have access to the database, the blockchain, the ledger. It's public. So I think in a nutshell, that is Bitcoin. Is it real? Well, no, but neither is the U.S. dollar. It's real only to the extent the government will back it up and say, okay, well, you can pay your taxes in that, or I mean, if you brought your dollar to a bank, they would give you dollars. You can't get gold for it. So does that satisfy? I know that's kind of it's a strange thing. But really, so is money in general a strange thing. We don't like to think about it because we don't want to undermine the full faith and credit of the U.S. dollar.
It's a strange answer.
It is a strange answer. I have a Bitcoin wallet. I have about 7 Bitcoins in it, and I'm watching this money, this go up, and it's like $28,000 now from nothing. It wasn't worth anything. I never bought any coin. I was just given coin by various people. Or you can mine it and create your own.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
I was wondering, if you bought a computer and it was let's say, $2,000, you bought it with one Bitcoin, do they give you, is there a breakdown of half of Bitcoin or what?
Yeah, you can break down Bitcoin infinitesimally fractional. So you can give out, I can give you a 10,000th of a Bitcoin. It's just numbers. Okay. It's just math. There's no coin either, although occasionally people will make up coins, but there is no coin. There's no physical reality to a Bitcoin. But think about it. Most of your financial transactions these days are done electronically, credit cards. You know, they're just bits too. It's a very interesting world. I think it's very intriguing. I do not recommend investing in Bitcoin. That's pretty speculative. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, Joseph from New Jersey. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hello, Leo. I'm a longtime listener, first time caller, and you showed on the live view the tiny hardware firewall, and I have a question about it.
Sure. So let me just explain what's going on so people are up to speed. Obviously, you are. There's a company out of Washington, D.C. called Wi-Fi Consulting, and I've been recommending for a couple of years now. They make a really clever solution for people who want to use coffee shops and other, you know, hotel Wi-Fi or Ethernet, other Internet access safely. And we've said before, it's a little risky because you're now joining a network that doesn't necessarily have any security on it. Anybody else on that network, which could be the guy sitting next to you in the coffee shop, can get to you and sometimes can mess with you in a variety of ways when you're on that network. So people really want to preserve their privacy and their security, but still want to use these kind of open networks at airports, hotels, coffee shops, can use a variety of devices. The one I've recommended is at tinyhardwarefirewall.com. And it's a hardware device. It's a router that you plug in to your USB port or your Ethernet jack. And if you have one, most laptops don't anymore. And then you go through it, and it protects you in a variety of ways. One, because it's a router. Two, because if you wish, you can also turn on virtual private networking, VPN, which will protect you even more. And you can anonymize yourself with these things, which is maybe even the third step using Tor. So these things are pretty sophisticated little routers in a USB key, basically. So there's the background. What's your question?
The question is that I looked at the pricing online, and it says that it's $35 for the Napoleon, but there's also $99 charge for the use of their VPN, and right underneath where they list that price, it says recurring charge.
Yes.
And I prefer TunnelBear as VPN.
That's completely legit. They don't do a hardware solution, that's all. So the idea of this is the company that sells this, Wi-Fi Consulting, is taking basically generic hardware, these little USB dongles and devices and radios and stuff, and modifying it so it uses their service, which either is Tiny Hardware Firewall, or they have a new service called the Black Hole Cloud Service, which is a little different than a traditional VPN. Each person who uses it has their own dedicated server, which means it's pretty fast. But yes, it's not, at least unless the new one is, which I have just received in the mail today, so I haven't set it up. It generally cannot be configured for a third-party firewall. Now, the reason, when I first started using this, you paid the firewall fee and the hardware was free. But they've now started charging an additional, you know, $35, kind of a small amount, but still a charge for the hardware. But you do need to keep renewing this every year and use their VPN, which you may or may not want to do.
Right, and I don't. And do you have an alternative to the Tiny Hardware Firewall from some other supplier?
Well, I would, I don't think TunnelBear, which is, by the way, a very good VPN service. One of the things you're looking for with VPN services is one that doesn't do any logging, that doesn't keep track of who's using it. That's part of the important anonymization of it. It doesn't have anything to do with the security of it. It just means that you're surfing completely privately, even from you know, law enforcement subpoenas, things like that. So a lot of people who use VPNs use it for both, you know, protect themselves against their ISP or snoops, but then they may also want to use it to protect themselves against lawful, unlawful search and seizure. And so that's an issue. So that's something you might want to look at. Tunnel Bear does do that. They delete their logs on the fly, so there's no immediate record, no searchable record, no subpoenable record of your use. So that's one reason people like Tunnel Bear. And Tunnel Bear's fast. It's a very good service. It's ineffective. I guess my in order to use it with a hardware device like this, unless they offer one pre-configured, you need to go buy one. And you can buy these. These are Marvell-based for the most part. That's an inexpensive embedded chip. They sell them on eBay. You just look for USB router or travel router. There are a lot of companies that make these, and those can be configured to use any VPN. Back to the phones from Farmington, Minnesota. I'm probably saying that wrong. Ivan, is it Farmington or Farmington?
Farmington.
Farmington. I think there's a missing R there. What can I do for you, Ivan?
So I just have a quick question for you. At the top of the show, I heard you talk about if you want to leave a comment on your site, logging in with your Facebook account or your Google account. And I see that on other websites as well. And I'm just wondering, when you do that, are you giving those websites any information?
Yeah, you sure are. So here's what's going on with that. They call it single sign-on. And it's actually a great idea. Instead of having to have a different account for every site, I don't want you or need you to create an account for techguylabs.com. But at the same time, I don't want people wandering in and putting spam comments up there. So it's just a little speed bump. They could still do it, but it's just a little speed bump. And what they do is, instead of having you create an account at techguylabs.com, I say you can use your existing account. And many services, Twitter offers this, Facebook offers this, Google offers it. Many, I think Microsoft has it as well. Many companies offer this as a convenience. If you push that button, Google, for instance, checks to see if you have a Google account. Now, probably you've already logged into Google on that browser. And if you have recently, there'll be a cookie, a little bit of information, a long digit stored on your hard drive, that is your Google cookie. And it's identified by, you know, a name that says it's Google.com. So pressing that button sends that cookie to Google, which verifies it and says, yeah, that's Ivan. And that's all we need. Our site will get that information. We will get your Gmail address. I think that's what they sent us. We don't use it. We discard it. But that's the transaction that goes on. Google will, if it wished to, and I imagine it does, could record the site that you're using. They could record the time of day. There's information you can ask the browser for, what the name of the browser, the version number of the browser, weird things like the resolution, the size of the window. There's a bunch of information the browser will give up, and Google could ask for that from the browser without any intervention on your part and record it. In some cases, and the security community is divided on this, it's conceivable that the browser might have other information about you, like if you recorded in your browser your address, as many do, for autofill, credit card numbers for autofill. It's conceivable that the browser might send them that as well, but it's my understanding that there are security measures in place to keep that from happening. So it is a little leak of your information. It's letting Google know you're on that site.
Right. Okay. So, but you're not actually giving them, when you log in with your password, you're not giving them your password.
Absolutely not. No. There's a really good system called OAuth and OAuth2 that Google and other sites use. You've probably seen this. If you hadn't logged into Google recently, it would pop up a window with the Google logo on it and asking you to log into your Google account. Same thing with Facebook, Twitter, Microsoft. If they didn't have that cookie on there, they would have you log in. That's not my site. That's a pop-up on top of my site that Google manages, and then Google sends a token back to me saying, yep, that's Ivan. That's using a system called OAuth. It's actually a very secure, well, mostly there have been flaws, but they patched them quickly. The mostly secure system. That's a good way of doing this. The problem, the whole you know, benevolent point of this is to make it so you don't have to create accounts everywhere you go. But admittedly, one of the incentives for Facebook, Google, Twitter, and Microsoft to do this is that they get more information about you. And since they already know all about you, Ivan, right? It's just one more bit of information. Oh, he's interested in the Tech Guy Labs.
Right.
But that's useful to them. They may from that infer that you are interested in technology stuff. You might get more technology ads on Google, something like that.
Okay, awesome.
All right.
That was it.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. You can, if you want to avoid this procedure, you can use an incognito window. Actually, you can verify this procedure. Use an incognito window. Press one of those buttons. You will be forced to log in. And at that point, you know, you're identifying yourself. I guess if you were nervous or wanted to be extra prudent, you could create a dummy account with Google that you never used except for this purpose. The problem is the internet and the web are essentially designed to be open systems for people who are willing to say who they are, to identify themselves and provide information. And I guess my thought is if you really don't want to share information about yourself, you either don't use the internet, because really that's the nature of the internet. I don't think it's a bad thing. It's the way the internet's designed. Or you'll have to take steps to travel anonymously on the internet. Things like, as we were talking about, this tiny hardware firewall, routers, VPNs, Tor. And these technologies slow down your access and complicate it a lot. Most people don't use it. And you might even say they kind of break the internet, because the internet is based upon this kind of trade of your personal information for free use of services like Google. You don't pay for that Google login or the Facebook login or the Microsoft login. You pay, in effect, with your information. And so if you don't do that, you might be saying you're kind of violating the agreement. The social agreement. Oh, I'm going to give you information in return for this service. And that's why I say all the time, and we say in our privacy policy, we don't collect this information. We don't want this information. Third parties might. Google might. We can't stop them from that if you use the Google login. But that's your choice. But we do not. I have no interest in that. Mostly because I know a lot of you would be offended by it. So we just don't. We monetize elsewhere, other ways. By selling ads. Let's go to St. Cloud, Florida. Jack is on the line. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Leo.
Hey, Jack.
I'm calling because I'm doing animate. I'm learning how to do animation, and I'm currently using a program called Blender. And I wanted to know some things, like some other programs I probably should get for making animations with this program. And I like, also I wanted to know a class. Like
Blender is a power tool. Blender is amazing, and I love it that you're using Blender. Are you on Linux or Windows? What are you on?
I'm on a Mac.
Okay, so Blender is what we call an open source program. That means it was created by people out of the goodness of their heart, and they don't charge you money for it, and they keep it up to date, and it's a power tool. The only problem with Blender at all, at least for people like me, you have a nimble, young and nimble mind, is it's hard to use. Do you find it hard to use?
Yeah, it gets hard at times.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
But if you learn Blender and you become good at Blender, man, you have a skill that you can take to the bank. I am not kidding. In fact, think about it. In the future, animation is going to continue to be huge, not just in movies, but everywhere. And the ability to do animation is a really great skill. So when you're using Blender to do animation, what kinds of animation are you doing?
Like, do you mean, like, what kind of style of animation?
What are you doing? Are you doing cartoons? Are you doing 3D rendering animation? Like, are you doing Pixar-style animation?
That's what I want to learn. That's what I'm trying to learn how to do.
Yeah.
But that's why I kind of want a recommendation for, like, softwares and a class that I could take, like, a good class, because
There are 71 nights until Christmas. And
You're impressive, Jack. So, of course, you've probably seen the tutorials at blender.org. But you want to go to the next step beyond that. And, of course, as with everything in the world, there are YouTube videos on how to do it. But I'm going to recommend there's a very good deal right now at Udemy, U-D-E-M-Y, which is – Udemy's a MOOC, massively online courseware. And the idea is it's like college-level courses, but you take them online. Some are free. You've probably tried Khan Academy classes, right?
Well, let me tell you.
I'm going to tell you one that's going to cost you $10 right now. Normally it's $200, but it's $10 right now. It's a Blender course at Udemy. 77,000 people are taking it. When I say massively online, that means a lot of people. But at that price, at $10, and the thing that's cool about this is you get a lot. It's 48 hours of on-demand video, but you also get to talk to an instructor. There's kind of tests and things like that. And because it's only $10, and you can take it as long as you need, right? So that's the beauty of this. It's $10, but you have it forever. So Udemy is very well known for their courses. And I would look at some of their other courses. They have other courses on sale right now.
I've seen Unity ones like for programming video games.
And there's some very simple ones, like here's creating a 3D soda can in Blender, step by step. But I would look at their courses, because that's one of the best places to take courses. And if it's I think you're smart. There are other programs that can do what you want to do, but I think mastering Blender. It's like if you're a musician, you want to learn every instrument, you could, but wouldn't it be best to master one instrument first and then learn more? So let's master Blender.
I already am.
Yeah. So master Blender. I think that's very, very good. It's a deep program. You'll get a lot of value out of. Here's the other thing. Once you master doing this in Blender, those skills will translate to all the other professional grade
like
tools.
Maya?
Like Maya, exactly. And Pixar has their own tools. But I think if you make some great audition materials for Blender, are you in high school right now?
No, I'm actually in middle school. I'm 12 years old.
Awesome. By the time you get in high school, you could apply. You'll have a great audition reel in Blender, and you could send it off to Pixar and say, I want to be an intern next summer in Emeryville, California. And you could, and I bet you could do it. And that's the next step, right? The first step is take these classes, make a great audition reel, make a lot of stuff, have fun with it. The next step is then go to where the masters are. You know, John Lasseter, the guy who created those great movies, Toy Story, was the director there. He studied,
really,
he worked at Disney, studied under Ub Iwerks, who is considered the legend, one of the great animators of all time. And one of the reasons John is so good at storytelling and animation is he studied at the foot of masters. And so that's the next step for you, an internship somewhere like Pixar or Disney. You're maybe a little closer to Disney. You'd probably get over to Orlando and do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay.
Have fun. I'm proud of you. You're doing great. Send me some animations. Leo, just anytime you feel like it, leo@techguylabs.com. If you do something cool, just send me a link, okay?
Okay.
Very impressive.
Thank you.
I bet you're way ahead of all the other kids in eighth grade.
I don't...
Yeah, you can be. Sometimes you can boast. Don't do it all the time. You can do it to me. You can say, "Yeah, I'm pretty good. I'm pretty good." Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I think he's pretty good. There he is, my friends. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, joins us every week to talk about photography. And you know, Chris, I love it because you span the entire range of photographic history from film cameras. Chris has a book on film photography that just came out, even. To your new podcast, which is all about the latest amazing technology.
Well, even beyond that, it goes into the future of photography.
Future.
That's also the title. Yep. Yeah, I'm an explorer. I want to learn. I want to know what's not just where this all comes from, but where it's going. And that's why, together with Adrian Stock, I started a new podcast.
The future of photography.
In addition to the other ones I do.
Where can I find it?
And anywhere you find podcasts.
Yeah.
It's The Future of Photography. There's only show with that, one show with that name. And, the reason we started the show is because the field of photography is in the middle of a massive revolution right now. And there are so many things going on. Just everyone, if you look at your smartphone, there are so many things in there you're not even aware of. We're looking at the software, artificial intelligence, looking at the photos and taking them and putting and chopping them into small pieces and discovering what is the sky, what is the ground, what is a person, treating those very differently. Just the latest thing in Apple's photos, the live photos thing, where they combine still photos with video. That is something that we haven't had before in that context, and that enables interesting features like making loops and long exposures out of individual photos. There's a lot of computation in photography, geometric corrections in cameras, for example. Sony RX100 is a very good example of that. The lens on that camera is not a good lens when you look at it optically. It has very strong geometric distortion, but the software in the camera takes care of that. So you can, or they can, use a cheaper lens or a lens that is more suited to the size of the camera, and the camera will take a care of the rest. And that's not only Sony doing this. Leica is doing this. Hasselblad is doing this. Pretty much everyone, I think, is doing it right now.
That's interesting. Leica is famous for the quality of its glass lenses.
They're fixing things. Trust me, they do. And a lot of that stuff happens in software, especially vignetting with wide-angle lenses, for example. Big problem with full-frame cameras. And that is all. The Leica, a digital Leica, will recognize what lens it is, what it is looking through, and then correct for that. A few years ago, we saw the Lytro. You might remember this little lipstick-type camera that allowed you to refocus photos after the fact. Now, that is gone now. They don't do consumer stuff anymore, but it's not over yet. They are in the professional field now. They are enabling these kind of things for movie production. Oh. So Hollywood is starting to use these cameras now in a much bigger form factor. But we're talking about cameras that not only can they fix the focus, so you don't have to reshoot if you had the focus wrong, they will also allow depth recognition. So all of a sudden, you will have... you will be able to shoot green screen footage without green screen. The camera knows where the background is, so it can just take it out and replace it with something else. Wow. AI is amazing. I mean, the photo enhancements we see in smartphones are just one thing, but content recognition. Smartphones now have AIs on board that can recognize the content of photos. So if you go into your smartphone's photo app and you type in cat, it will find cats, and not cats that you tagged, cats that is discovered. But that goes beyond that. They were talking about things like sentiment recognition. So cameras will...
That day you were angry? Here's the pictures from that day. Really?
Well, or only take a photo where I smile.
Wow.
Depth sensing is a part of most cameras nowadays that have two lenses. The iPhones 8 and some of the Androids, they have depth sensors. The iPhone 10 now has a depth sensor looking at you that will pretty much in the future see depth sensors looking into the other direction, and that will help them to recognize the content even better. What's out there, it will look at your desk and it will be able to tell you this is a pen and this is a keyboard and this is a computer. And then that will filter into new applications for stuff like augmented reality, mixed reality. If we look at even at software post-production, if you look at photos and what we do with them nowadays, there is now, I've seen this example by Adobe. They call a new algorithm they want to use Deep Fill, which is pretty much a content-aware fill. And you've used that if you have a branch going through the sky, you just tell it, fill it with whatever fits there. But that's not perfect. Now, they have added new stuff in there, intelligence in there that now understands what's in the photo. So it will understand, oh, this is sky. I need to replace that with sky. So it's not just going to go through the photo and trying to find something that it can copy into that. It will computationally know what's in the photo. And this is all technology.
Is this happening now? Because I do see a lot of ads.
This is all happening.
For
yes,
these kinds of things. There's a company called MacFun that says we can, they show a picture of a person at the beach, as always at the beach, lots of other people, and they just say, oh, you just erase them. Really?
Yep. Oh, this is
that works.
This is the least. This is easy.
But how does it know what's behind those people? I mean, how does it know what that beach looks like?
Well, the way they do it is they showed the artificial intelligence millions of photos with beaches on them. So it will now know, wait a minute, this is a beach. Take the person out. I will replace it with stuff that looks like a beach.
So what that means is if you're looking at a still image, you can't trust it anymore. It could be...
No, of course. I couldn't for a long time.
For a long time because of Photoshop. But now anybody can do it. Yeah. Right?
This is interesting because it means that we have... Well, pretty much more democracy in that respect. Photographers, this is now not only for the pros. It's becoming easier for people with less skills in that area to do these things. And we are already seeing a lot of this on our smartphones. I am sure that the bigger cameras, the bigger DSLRs at one point in time will go away because we don't need them anymore.
Right.
Now, this
is
in the future, but hey... There's a lot of great stuff. And in the future of photography, in the show, this is what we're looking at. We're looking at what the tech does and what that means for us. Does it mean we need less skill? Does it mean we will get better results with the same skill? Or does it mean we don't need any skill at all? And cameras do everything for us. There's a lot of stuff that we...
Photographers must hate this.
Well, but look back at other professions that used to be very skillful, and now you don't need that skill anymore. So I think that's going to change. It will change for sure.
And photographers, I imagine you're a professional photographer, so you must feel like, well, there's things that we can find to do that computers can't do yet.
Of course, I'm proud of my skill. You know, I'm proud of what I can do and what I learned and what I spent time with. But I can do two things. I can either go and cover my ears and go la la la, I'm not listening, or I can look at it and see what can it do for me.
Yeah.
And that's what we're doing on the future of photography.
Wow, I want to listen to this show because it's happening. It's happening faster than we thought. I remember talking 5-6 years ago. With the folks from Nokia, because Nokia was starting to put these very fancy cameras in their phones, 41 megapixel cameras, things like that. And I remember talking with a guy from Nokia about it, and he said, well, this is the future. This is computational photography. Well, the future is finally kind of here when you look at phones like the Pixel 2 XL, which does with one lens what most other phones take two lenses to do, and the portrait modes in the new iPhones. These things really are new and different. The Future of Photography, it's a brand new podcast. You'll find it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm subscribing. Back to the phones, and Nancy is in Tarzana, our next caller. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Leo.
Thanks for hanging on. What can I do for you today?
I've been on 2 hours.
Oh, my gosh. I am so sorry. You're very patient. Thank you.
Anyways, what I wanted to ask you, and it was about... the difference between the Echo and the Google Home. I have an Android, and I was also going to buy it for my kids. And they have iPhones.
So that doesn't matter. Although, because you have Android, you might know a little bit more about what the Echo, the Google Home does, because essentially the Google Home is the same thing as the Google Assistant in your Android phone. Do you ever talk to your Android phone?
On Google?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You say, okay, Google, and ask it a question. Right. That's basically exactly the same as the Google Home. So anything it's a good way to practice and see if it's useful. There is a significant difference in capabilities. Amazon's Echo came out 2 years before Google Home did. The idea is basically the same. They're a little device with a speaker and a what they call an array microphone, 6 or 7 or sometimes even more microphones that are designed for picking up your voice even at a distance so you can talk across the room to it. And they're very accurate. They both have trigger words, Hey Google or OK Google for the Google Home. For the Amazon Echo, there's a variety of them, including Alexa, Echo, Amazon, and computer. You get to choose. So you say the trigger word, and then depending on how you've said it, sometimes they go bloop, sometimes they don't. You can have it either way. And then you speak. Usually I just will say one sentence. I will say, hey, Echo, what time is it in Botswana? And then she'll respond. Both are pretty good at basic things like that. The Google is better for facts. So, for instance, last night we were wondering when's the last time the Dodgers won the World Series. And that was something that, the Google did a very good job with, quoting the year, who, you know, pitcher, also even reading a little bit of an article. It was very good for the factual stuff. The Echo is better in terms of home automation. There's a wide range of devices, from lights to cameras to key, you know, door locks, that work with the Amazon Echo. I can say, hey, Echo, how much gas is in my tank? Hey, Echo, open the garage door. All of those things, if you have the right devices, will work with the Echo, and not yet with Google, although Google hopes to do something similar eventually. Both will allow you to make phone calls to any phone number in the United States. Google Home had it first, but Amazon's added that. Echo has an interesting, if you have more than one Echo, feature that the Home does not have, an intercom feature. So you can talk from one Echo to another. We have an Echo in our kitchen and an Echo in our bedroom, and I can say, hey, honey, it's time for dinner, through the Echoes, like an intercom system without any wiring. It's really remarkable. Echo is good at music, but so is Google Home. Amazon's Echo works better with Amazon services like Amazon Music and Amazon Unlimited. The Google Home works with Spotify, Pandora, and, of course, Google's own music. So both of them will play music. Both of them will be kitchen timers. They're very similar in that functionality. Google Home has one ability that the Echo doesn't have, which is if you use Chromecast, if you have a TV that's cast ready, or you put a Chromecast on your TV, you can have the Google Home cast video to the television. You could say, I want to watch Stranger Things on Netflix, and it'll actually start up the TV and put it on there, which is kind of neat. In other words, if you're kind of in the Google ecosystem, it doesn't matter what kind of phone you have. That's really irrelevant. Do your family members shop on Amazon a lot? Because that's another advantage that the Echo has.
Yes.
I do that all the time. When we run out of batteries, I'll say, Echo, buy AAA batteries. And she'll respond back, well, the last time you bought AAA batteries, it was this. Would you like me to order those? You could set it up with a PIN so that the kids can't just buy candy. She'll say, what's your PIN? And I'll say my PIN number, and then it will order them, and they come. I didn't have to do anything else. I love that feature. Google's getting some of those features, but they have to do it because they're not a shopping service. They have to do it in partnership with Walmart, Target, and some other companies. But eventually, I think Google's hope is to do the same thing. They're more similar than they're different.
Do you think Apple will ever come out with something like that?
In December, Apple is putting Siri on something they call the HomePod, which is almost exactly the same, except that they're aiming more at a high-quality sound. So it's going to really be a speaker that has Siri built into it than a Siri device. And I don't think Siri is, if you've used the iPhone and your family has, Siri is not quite as capable as either Echo or Google. It's kind of dumb in my experience. I find that when I ask Siri stuff, it will often say, well, I don't know what you're talking about, but here's what I found on the web, which is usually not what I wanted.
Oh, okay.
All of these are a little bit dumb. Don't expect, you know, HAL 9000. It's not, you know.
Well, my question, too, is because it's all done, I guess, by internet or waves, how much do you put yourself at risk?
Isn't that a great question? It is not sending your audio there constantly. So the way these devices all work, they have processors in them, and they're not sending anything back to the home office until they hear the trigger word. So all that's going on is they're in a constant loop saying, did you say Echo? 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 When it hears talking, it matches it up to the sound form of Echo. That's all it does, and it's done all internally, and all these devices work that way. Once it says, oh, she said Echo, it continues to listen, and that audio is sent to Amazon or Google or Apple, whoever the home company is. In fact, you can look on Google and see everything you've asked Google Assistant. You can listen to it. You can listen to all the things you've ever asked Google, which is a little creepy.
No, because sometimes I wonder, because I've heard that Google is not as respectful with your personal information. So
I think Google is very respectful, but I think Google collects a lot. So Apple knows a lot about you, but has said very specifically, very explicitly, we're not going to do anything with that. Although, if you read the privacy statement for all these companies, in every case, they say, we will share it with third parties for certain you know, things. Google, yeah, Google shares it with third parties for advertising. And they don't say, oh, hey, listen, Nancy just asked about a vacation, so would you send her some luggage ads? Doesn't quite work like that. But they are trying to customize ads based on the things they know about you, and that includes things you might ask for, buy, watch on TV, stuff like that.
Well, that's what I wondered with all.
Yeah, but with Amazon, you can't delete that. With Google, you can. So Amazon's paying attention too. Believe me, they want to know. They want to mine your data for shopping. So Amazon's very much collecting your data. The only company that says they're not, and I'm not convinced that it's even the fact, is Apple. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. So I know it's kind of a. I had to break there, but I'm still with you.
Okay. You know how much the Apple will be?
It's going to be expensive. I think it's $400.
Oh, forget that.
The Apple's going to be nice for music. In fact, what Apple's trying to do is a really great speaker system that will adapt to the sound, to the furniture in your room, and it'll adapt the sound to it. The Siri part is very secondary to it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so the best deal right now is Echo and Google, and both Google's $129. Echo, I think they have now one sub. They have several sub $100 ones. They have one that's $40, the Dot, but that needs a speaker system hooked up to it. The Dot's great though, if you just want to try Echo, and you can hook it up to speakers or a stereo system. Because that's how I use my Dot. I have it hooked up to some nice speakers in the bedroom, and I can, and it's nice because this is the single most useful thing. I could say, "Hey Echo, let's listen to some classic rock." And it'll play music.
Huh.
It's really nice. Google also has a little device like that, the Mini, that's $50. It's a little more expensive. Same idea, though.
Huh. Okay.
Apple's a latecomer to this. They still haven't released their product. I don't know how you feel about Siri. You use Android, so you may not have an opinion, but my experience with Siri is it's not that bright.
No, I use the Android because I just didn't need anything that sophisticated, you know?
I would say if you had to choose.
Yeah.
Echo is better for shopping, for sure, and for home automation. Google is better for asking for information and playing video if you have the right equipment on your TV.
Oh, I don't do any of that.
Yeah. I think Echo's the king. I mean, and by the way, the hardest thing is not deciding whether to buy Google or Echo, but which Echo, because there's an Echo that's just a tube. There's a new silver Echo that's supposed to be better. There's a little Echo that's like an alarm clock. There's an orb. There's the one I like and my mom loves is the Echo Show. This is the one I would look at. It's got a 7-inch screen on it. So it uses in all sorts of ways. For instance, you can say, I'll do it right now. Echo, show me my dash buttons. And it'll have.
Here you go. These, press the buttons to order.
I can order from the buttons, the dash buttons that so I can order toilet paper just by pressing a button or, a screen is really interesting in conjunction with this. It also has a better speaker. So if you're giving as a gift or for yourself, probably the one I'd recommend, it's a little more expensive, is the Echo Show because it has a screen.
Okay.
I really like the Echo Show.
How much is the Echo Show?
I think it's $200, maybe $229.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
okay.
So if you're not sure, get a Dot and see if you like it. The Dot doesn't have any screen, and you need speakers.
You definitely need speakers.
Yeah, if you have old computer speakers. The problem with the Echo Tube is it's not the best speaker ever. So really, if music's important to you, I would say get the Dot, which is cheaper, and hook it up to a nice pair of speakers.
Okay.
You can also use it as a speaker phone. It has a lot of, you know, once you get one of these, I think you'll see a lot of uses for it.
Okay. Will you help me with my shopping? That's what it'll be.
It's going to be a great Echo Christmas.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Bye-bye. Brian's in Panama City, Florida. Hi, Brian. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, Leo. Good to talk to you. Thanks
nice
for having
to talk
me
to
on.
You. Thanks for calling.
Well, I was listening to your monologue about net neutrality, and I couldn't really tell if you are in favor of this move by the FCC or if you're opposed to it.
Oh, I'm dead opposed to it. As, by the way, I'm not alone in this. A letter was written from some of the founders of the Internet and people who currently run the Internet several dozen strong, including Vince Cerf, who is widely considered the father of the net, who said that we need the net was born open and neutral and needs to stay that way. And what the FCC has done is to benefit big internet service providers at the detriment of us end users.
Well, I am very concerned anytime the government wants to regulate anything. So I'm.
Do you trust the water coming out of your tap?
I do, but
that's government regulated because government has water safety restrictions, and that's a good thing.
Understandable.
Before we go any farther, you would agree some government regulation is a good thing.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Course. Yeah. So
if you're dogmatically opposed to that, then you're right. We shouldn't have any regulations.
I'm not saying any, but you know, the water companies, as you mentioned, they're regulated at a local level. But when you're talking about something that can be basically dictated by those who, you know, are currently in power, I get a little concerned. So, for instance, you were concerned about people having their thumb on the scale. You know, the ultimate scale exists in Washington, D.C., and I'm afraid that if you have people, Comcast, you know, whoever the big guys are, when the rule is in place, that they can simply make enough donations that they can convince the people who are in power at the time to dictate exactly what neutral is.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, we have to, if we have regulations, it has to be regulators who are fair. We need umpires, and they have to be trusted and fair. But I think that's exactly what you describe has already happened. That's exactly what's happened. Comcast and Verizon and AT&T have spent a lot of money on Congress and have effectively said, we don't want anybody to tell us what to do. We want to be able to make a little more money by charging a little more for certain content, by blocking content that competes with our businesses. That's what just happened. So I understand what you're saying. You're worried that regulators might put the thumb on the scale in the other way, and that's always a risk. But I would submit that's what just happened.
Well, when you say that is just what happened, what do you mean?
By throwing out rules that have been in place. And people sometimes say, oh, no, that rule is a 2015 rule. It's true, but there were rules prior to it that the courts threw out. Verizon sued, and the courts said to the FCC, you don't have the authority to regulate unless you declare internet service providers to be common carriers. And then you do have authority to regulate common carriers like the phone company. So the FCC in 2015 said, all right, we declare them to be common carriers under Title II of the Telecommunications Act, and we will regulate them. We'll use a light touch regulation because that Title II does allow them to do things like set tariffs, and they're not going to do that, and they haven't done that. But they do have a mandate to regulate the phone company, and they say, well, as far as we're concerned, internet service providers act much like a phone company. They pass information along without modifying it. They are common carriers. So that regulation in 2015 was a change, but it effectively gave them the same powers to do what they had been doing since the very beginning. And I'll use it as – there are many examples, but I used as an example AT&T, which the FCC said – you blocked FaceTime, saying, well, it's a competitive product to our phone service. We don't want you to use it. So AT&T customers couldn't use FaceTime. The FCC stepped in. And I think, do you disagree? This was quite rightly so, said to AT&T, you can't block FaceTime.
No, I agree with that. And that's what you're talking about, I think, as far as the light touch regulation. So there were things happening even, you know, previous to this larger law that was put in place in 2015 that seemed to be working. You know, and when you guys were having the conversation about email providers being able to email somebody who's not on the same system that you are, all of that happened before this concept of net neutrality.
No, it didn't. No, it didn't. This is Fox. You're parroting a line that's coming from Fox News that I really want people to understand. It's one of the reasons I said this at the beginning of the show, because I read an editorial from Fox News. We have always had net neutrality. Larry Lessig, who is a legend, a constitutional lawyer and one of the early proponents of the internet, pointed out from day one, we've had net neutrality, and it's been protected in some cases by the FCC. And I can point again to more and more cases of that. The court said you need authority to do this. The FCC said, all right, we'll use Title II. There are perils to Title II because it lets us do a lot more than simply protect net neutrality. But I don't know of any case since 2015 where they have done that. They said light touch regulation. Maybe what we need, and I would welcome this, is to go back to Congress and say, all right, we don't want to use Title II of the Telecommunications Act, but you need to give the FCC authority to prevent internet service providers from doing things to benefit their business that's in, you know, not in the interest of the people, we the people of the United States. If you are with me on that, then let's do that. Let's go to Congress and say, let's give us a law that does that.
Yeah, that sounds fine. But, you know, when you're talking about competition, when you have one company that is...
There is no competition. You understand that. More than half the country has one internet service provider. 86% of the country has two internet service providers. That's the problem.
But you do have regional ISPs, though. And, you know, for the regional ISPs, if the big guys are not acting in the best interest of the customers, you still have some regional ISPs people can go to. You know, as an alternative.
Most people do not have that option. You may be lucky enough to have that. If you're in an urban area, you probably do. In most cases, it's the phone company or the cable company or nothing.
Yeah, well, there still are some out there. And I'm afraid that under the concept of net neutrality that they could be wiped out.
We're using a regional ISP we love called SonicNet. They're very strongly in favor of net neutrality. They're very upset about what Ajit Pai and the FCC did on Friday. They feel that this is going to be a very big competitive problem for them.
Interesting. Well, the local regional ISPs in my area are actually afraid of the concept of net neutrality because they are afraid that the larger ISPs are going to be able to go to Congress and make the amount of donations that would be required to eliminate that.
We should be afraid of that. You're right. I agree. I mean, this is the biggest problem we have in the United States right now. We have the best Congress money can buy. And they act in favor. They absolutely act, as does the FCC, to benefit the big donors. But they really need to be the referees on the playing field acting for we the people. We need to make sure that happens. And as voters, I hope you would do that. Turning away the regulations that protected us absolutely undermines the protections we had. It's saying no rules at all. And you watch, because there's no way the FCC can now say to AT&T, don't block FaceTime. There's no way they can say to Comcast, don't block BitTorrent. There's no way they can say to Verizon, you can't charge more for access to YouTube. And you just watch. Without the power to do that, these companies absolutely will. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. And that's it. All of the best stuff. Well, there's some of the best stuff from 2017 in the Tech Guy Show. I will be back soon, actually. I'll be back in 1 week, Saturday, January 6th. All new Tech Guy, all new questions and answers on the radio, on the podcast. As always, you can watch the Tech Guy as we do it live, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Pacific. That's 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern time, twit.tv/live. If you do that, join us in the live chat room, irc.twit.tv. You can also listen on your live local radio station. We're all over the country, and we really appreciate the Premier Network and their broadcasts all over the country, especially some of the big boys like KFI in Los Angeles, KSFO in San Francisco. And, you know, that's really important to the show. So if you get a chance, if you're in an area where you can listen locally, do listen locally. Patronize your local radio station. But if you miss an episode or you want to watch live, as we do it live Saturday and Sunday, this is the place to be. Get the podcast. Thank you so much for being here all year long. I hope you have a wonderful new year, 2018. And I will be back next Saturday and Sunday with brand new Tech Guy shows. Happy New Year, everybody. We'll see you then. Bye-bye. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy Show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.